Detroit. Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter.
You've been in the studio recording, huh?
I had my throat. You can kind of hear it. I sang my little heart out.
Yeah, well, that's good. So it's going to be another CD?
Well, I'm going to just put out singles. You know, people really don't put people.
I'm so behind the times.
I kind of was, too, because I thought I'm just going to do an EP this time. You know, which is just a few songs. And the guy that I'm working with, my engineer, he goes, Jillian, people just put out singles now. I go, so I'm just going to put out some singles. It's going to be a little while. The guy I work with is very picky about music, which I like a lot. Mm-hmm. And so shout out to Dietrich Bonowitz, who plays in a local band called Monkey Grinder.
All right. Wow. Hey, and is it so it's going to be online?
I'll be putting it out online, and I'll put it up on our Facebook page when I get it, because I'm doing an anti-war song that I wrote called Blank Faces, Blank Stares.
Wow.
I know. I'm kind of PO'd in the song. And in fact, to the point where I have this this white rapper coming in to really tell it.
Okay. Jolene Jordan, singer-songwriter. I don't know the etiquette here. Do we want to direct people to?
No, just, yeah. I mean,
just stay tuned.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you Google my name and say music, my songs are all over the internet.
Yeah, except
for free.
Your first name throws people as much as my last name.
It's true.
Yeah,
Juline.
So it's like Juline.
It's like Juline, but it's Jolene.
Jolene Jordan. Yeah. And I'm Peter Werby. And you go to Peter Werby, WERBE.com. That's a website. I guess that's 20th century too, huh?
No, not yet.
Well, I think so. But anyway, we also, into the 21st century with Facebook, you can check out the Night Call Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Night Call. We likes. A lot of folks
love them.
A lot of stuff. In fact, I actually don't have it up there, but someone just sent us a whole bunch of songs.
Oh, yeah. Let me pull it up.
Yeah. These songs, and it's me. May seem like, a swan song. They're songs of the Wisconsin protest. Now, I don't think everybody...
And they're not done protesting in Wisconsin yet.
Wisconsin just had a recall election of Governor Scott Walker, who decided to destroy unions in his state as a way of overcoming a deficit. Mm-hmm. And it is so complicated, and it's mostly all lies, and it's part of this Republic.
And money and corruption.
Who knows? Governor Scott Walker could be indicted for corruption in Milwaukee County.
Because he has a lot of corruption amongst his people as well. And so that's WisconsinProtestSongs.com. Songs of Uprising, Wisconsin Protest Songs, Cheddar Revolution.
Yeah.
Are your headphones loud, Peter?
Yeah, why? They sound weird.
No, I don't know.
Why?
I think you're just...
You keep hearing your feedback?
Bad. Okay. Yeah. Maybe it's me.
One of the songs on that album, I don't know if you noticed, is by the former MC5 lead guitarist, Wayne Kramer.
Which leads into one of your interviews tonight.
Yes, and the MC5, I hope everybody, no matter how old you are, know who the MC5 were.
If you're from Detroit,
If you're from Detroit, for sure. But, you know, people talk about the MC5 all over the world as being, always this phrase, seminal rock band, of everything, of being the progenitor. Wow. sometimes I scare myself.
Of
punk music, of stage performance, of wild guitar playing. I mean, a lot of that was going on in Detroit at the Grandy Ballroom back in the late 60s and early 70s. But Wayne Kramer is the lead guitar, considered by Rolling Stone magazine to be one of the top 100 guitarists of all time, rock and roll guitarists of all time.
Well, they are right on about that.
Yeah.
The only memory I have of those are in pictures. I wish I could have been around for the Grandy Ballroom days.
I do keep getting feedback, don't I?
Yeah.
If you go to my website, and some of the song of Wisconsin Protest is on our Facebook page.
Yep.
But if you go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, you can click on both the album But also Wayne Kramer, the MC5, and isn't there a third little element? I should take a look at it.
Check it all out.
But anyways, this guy's amazing. And so I know Wayne from way back in the day. Mm-hmm. But then I come to find out that he's scored all this music for HBO films and documentaries, that he does the bumper music and the music, you know, in and out of spots for ESPN.
Which are commercials.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Wayne is a ton.
Yeah, he's something else, and just what every musician probably wishes they could do for longevity if they're not like Mick Jagger, you yeah. know, where you play until you're however old it will be he plays until, but where you branch off into all these other areas, producing and getting into film and television, it's wonderful.
It didn't work well for a lot of the guys in the band because of the MC5, three of them have passed away.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that's unfortunate, including Patti Smith's husband, Fred Sonic Smith, and Patti Smith yeah. performed at the Detroit Institute of Arts
right.
with her
and
band.
She has a photography exhibit there
yeah. Yeah.
right now that you can go see for free with museum admission.
Right, and she Wanna is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
She's amazing.
True. She is amazing.
I love her.
Yeah.
I saw her play down at St. Andrews once. And
really?
Small venue. Yeah, small venue. And she spits a lot.
She
you know,
does.
Oh, man.
She spits on
she's
stage.
She's barefoot, and she walks on top of the spit, and she does not care, and I love her. I couldn't spit and walk in my own spit. I could spit. I could
it's
be
not
barefoot.
Good to spit.
But separately.
No, it's not good to spit.
What is up with spitting anyway? That's for another show.
No. This is like a Chinese medicine thing.
Really?
This is your chi is in the spit.
Patty, quit spitting.
The chi comes up your spine and in through your mouth, and then you want to swallow and goes back down. So
yeah.
it all circulates.
That's so gross. But it's better than what
wait a minute. You
got to
do
around.
One of two things with your saliva.
Oh, let's not go there.
You either
got to
swallow it or spit it.
Stop there.
Are we on the air yet?
We are right here, live.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Usually
Every
we talk
week,
about politics.
Yeah, and we're going to.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Our phone number, and if you'd like to talk about let's not talk about spitting. Anything else, 313.
That's the morning show.
Yeah, that's right. 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743. It is a call-in talk show, and we want you to call.
Yeah, and if you'd like to email us, though, if you got a short comment, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I know sometimes people will send a manifesto, and I read it, but I'm not going to read it on the air.
You
and
read
I
it, said, like, during the week.
I have sometimes read it, like, weeks later.
Right,
yeah.
Yes. It'd be a little overwhelming at times.
Yes. So we have a couple of our favorite people screening calls.
Yes, we have John and Athena in the other room.
Yeah.
So be kind to them. Save it for us.
Yeah. We can take it.
Yes.
I mean, they could too, but they
can take it, but it's not their
do.
Job.
That's right. All right. I suspect, and I've been finding this out, you know, I've been in this little hassle with the New York Times where I get a lot of my initial information about world events. So from the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I haven't received it. I know that's kind of old school, you know,
what
reading,
do you mean?
Reading a newspaper. I'm having it out
You're
with them.
You're not getting the newspaper.
I'm not getting it. So I haven't. So
You're
I begin.
Biding the Times.
So I begin to understand how, you know, we talk about low information voters.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty easy in this society to be low information.
I think so too.
Because there's
in this country especially.
Yeah, and it's not. I mean, it's all out there, like on these news sites, but. You know, it's hard to read really in-depth stuff.
Yeah, you have to go looking for it, and then usually what you get on most of these sites requires more research.
Yeah, right. But so, I feel like I don't know half of the information I usually have.
Oh, I don't believe it.
Well, okay. But here's the deal. But here, I'm understanding, like I said to somebody, what was the deal in Wisconsin?
The little recall thing?
Yeah, so it isn't something that is on the tip of everybody's tongue, that everybody listening to WRIF is going, oh, yeah, I got an opinion on Governor Scott
yeah,
Walker.
Yeah, how did he stay in
yeah.
there? And
so probably a lot of people don't even know what this deal is, and you would think, wait a minute, there was a recall, which means you're going to try to vote the guy out that was voted in the general election.
The governor of Wisconsin,
and so what? And what do I care, or what do we care? Well, I mean, I think this has a lot of significance. So this is this Republican that got in with a lot of these Republicans in 2010 when all the ebullient Democrats that provided the over-the-top vote for Barack mm-hmm. Obama in 2008 just stayed home. So the Republicans keep saying, you know, the American people have spoken, and they've put in all these insane right-wing Republicans
yeah.
into office and all these right-wing governors like Snyder here and Scott Walker in Wisconsin and Rick Scott in Florida. I mean, mm-hmm. there's tons of them. But really what it was, I mean, the turnout in 2010 was so low. And, I mean, that's the way the cookie crumbles. If people don't come out, that's one of the consequences that they'll receive.
Yes.
Anyway, so Scott Walker is part of this whole far right-wing push financed by billionaires to
the Koch brothers.
Yeah, to destroy the Democratic Party and to destroy labor unions so that they can essentially return to the 19th century when there was two classes. There was a small ruling wealthy elite, mm-hmm. a ruling class, and then beneath it there was a working class.
Yeah, what's that saying? Those who...
What? Oh, the golden rule?
Yeah.
Those that have the gold rule.
Right.
Or the melting pot.
Which one's that?
That's the scum rises to the top and those in the bottom get burned.
Right. It's true.
Yeah. But in any event, there was, what happened in the 1930s was that because the economy, essentially run by the Republicans back then as well in the 1920s that crashed it, they figured out that it would be a good idea to get everybody working again and in two ways. I mean, one, that the government became a massive employer and I mean, talk about stimulus. They, I mean, hired millions and millions of people in a variety of jobs, everything from planting trees to acting on stage. I mean, they had the Works Progress Administration and the theater projects and what have you. They also passed something called the Wagner Act in 1935 that protected and encouraged the formation of labor unions. And wait a minute, they're somewhere
far cry from today.
Yeah, exactly. And what went on then was that, here it is, actually. I don't even have to remember this. This is very important. As unions decline, wage inequality rises. So as
wage inequality, not wage and equality, because it sounded like that, yeah.
To a remarkable extent, this is by Vice President Ross Eisenbray, who is the EPI, Economic Policy Institute. That's what it's for, right. To a remarkable extent, inequality, which fell during the New Deal, but has risen dramatically since the late 1970, corresponds to the rise and fall of unionization in the United States. We're going to be talking about Wisconsin, but this is setting the stage. The passage in 1935 of the National Labor Relations Act, which protected and encouraged unions, sparked a wave of unionization that led to three decades of shared prosperity and what some call the Great Compression. And what that means, the share of national income taken by the very rich was cut by one-third.
Really?
So that's massive income redistribution.
Which we talk about time here.
That's communism! You know what that's called, my friends? How many of you feel like you're in the middle class? Well, I know not all of you. I know a lot of you have taken some...
Wait, there is one?
Yeah, a lot of you have taken some bad hits. A lot of you probably consider yourself more in the working class and some even in the poor that are listening.
Yeah.
But a lot of us feel like we're in the middle class, and that's where that money went to. That's where that third that essentially was taken from the upper elite and transferred to the classes below them that created the middle class in this country. And that's what the Republicans are trying to unravel. That's what they want to end. That's what they want to send back when there's no unions, no laws, no regulation, no laws against the practices that have restrained unrestricted financial activity, no work standards, no safety standards, nothing.
Because it's amazing to me
that's the free market. Remember, anytime someone mentions free market, either grab your wallet or grab some instrument of self-protection,
right?
Because they're coming for your ass.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me, just in general conversation throughout the week between shows, of the amount of hatred that people have toward unions. They just really have just this horrible. I don't know. I think they've been misled. I really believe that.
But. Well, that ties in, and I will get to that in a minute, with the recall of the Governor Scott Walker that failed miserably in Wisconsin last Tuesday. Well, the labor unions have what they call a countervailing power. That is the power of capital, the power of the wealthy elite of this country that controls everything. Even when unions are strong, they still control almost everything. But at least the unions and the New Deal, the government of of Roosevelt and of Truman and Kennedy and, well, you know, actually, never mind. Let's just end it there at that period. I mean, it gets complicated. It's not like the Democrats don't have some complicity in all of this as well. But I don't understand this. I mean, without a union, and think what it, I mean, a union becomes kind of a proper noun as opposed to a descriptive phrase. In other words, a union is a union of wage earners, of wage workers, right? And the reason that people did this is because it's not like somebody said, you know, I've got a lot of managerial skills, and I want to start a woolen production facility here in well, let's forget England. I mean, that's where it kind of started. But in the northeastern United States, the 1830s, and, you know, we're all neighbors. You know, I know all of you.
Yeah.
And what we're going to do is I'm going to manage things, and I'm going to take on the responsibility. I'm also going to take on the risk, but I'm going to pay you guys to the largest extent possible, work you the least amount, but also that it means that I make a profit and you get a wage and the enterprise continues. Of course, they didn't do that. What they did, in fact, was how can I extract the most value from the labor that I'm buying from you, which means working you 12 and 13 hours a day, working kids in factories, having no safety standards whatsoever, despoiling the environment. Yeah, that's the free market, folks. In fact, there are people that argue, forgetting about the deep humiliation and awful evil that slavery was, that slaves actually had it better than early industrial workers. Free labor.
And explain that.
Okay.
Because I'm sure there are people who are
Whoa. Yeah. As I said, is that you didn't get any days off. I mean, maybe somebody had Sunday to go to church. But if you were an industrial worker in these mills, say, in Massachusetts in 1840, like that, you were literally worked to death. The slave owners, which, you know, there's very few person-to-person greater evils than slavery.
Yeah.
It was seasonal work. When it was time to work, it was, the slaves worked from, can see to can't see, as they used to say, mm-hmm. and we know all the brutality of slavery.
Oh, absolutely.
But there were great down periods. There was, the capacity of, because they had large gangs of workers, they worked they worked the minimal amount possible, whereas the industrial workers were chained to machines. I mean, sometimes literally, but the machines set the pace. I mean, this is no argument for slavery at all. As I
Ever.
Said, it's horribly evil. But the original industrial capitalism actually had working conditions worse than slavery. I'm not talking about, they didn't break up families. They just destroyed families by never letting people ever, get together and destroying their health and everything like that. Slave owners had a vested interest in keeping slaves healthy.
Well,
they were property.
Keep them around, yeah.
Yeah, they were properties. They were commodities. I mean, that's horrible. It doesn't get any more horrible or awful than that. It's an ethical concept. All justified by the Bible. You know, these were the greatest Christian believers down there. I am so far afield from all of this. I cannot believe.
Come back, Jimmy Peter.
But anyways, that's the free market. The free market had its greatest expression in the 1840s, where any sense of humanity, either in the slavery of the South, and it was the same people, the same people now that are the rulers, the elite, are the same people that were the slave owners and the same people that were the factory owners.
And they'd like to have all of their workers working for slave wages.
Yeah, yeah, right.
As little to nothing as possible.
Yeah.
And not with not one care about their quality of life, their families, their children, their future.
Yeah. And you got to remember that none of these people, I mean, the fact that like now 300 children an hour die of starvation in the world, none of this has to happen. There's enough wealth in the world that nobody has to be poor. Nobody has to starve. We don't have to be fighting wars for resources.
Yeah.
We don't have to be occupying other countries. We don't have to have $1 trillion military budgets, except in this system, I guess, for lack of a better word, that we currently live under.
The war economy.
Okay. So let's get back to labor unions. So labor unions are a countervailing power. You have this enormous power of wealth because they control the apparatus that works in their interest, the government. And, I mean, sometimes you get governments a little more fairer than others, like during the 1930s, this little teeny window when this happened, say between, mm-hmm. 1935 and, the 1970s.
Right.
So without a union of wage earners, it is then you against the ultra wealthy, who have the capacity to hire and fire you, determine the conditions of your work, which whether or not you get a pension,
which
means you don't have squat. Yeah. That's why people have unionized. If the capitalist at the outset would have created a humane system, none of this would ever be happening. If they really saw themselves as neighbors and part of a community and understood that maybe they had some better managerial skills than the wage, which I don't even think is true. I mean, companies could operate without man. I mean, there's tons of...
Without that much management.
Well, there's this big cooperative project in Spain called Mondragon. It looks like Mondragon, mm-hmm. Dragon, you know, Mondragon. And if you Google that, it's incredible. I mean, it's an enormous workers cooperative that, you know, where decisions are made cooperatively and it's successful. And while, you know, Spain is, you know, falling apart.
Having some issues right
now. Yeah,
there.
Having some issues with all the, you know, the richy rich guys, that are the brains that have just ruined the economy with, you know, the way, their counterparts here did in the United States with, Reaganomics. But anyway, if they would have created a humane society to begin with, none of this would be happening at all. But the greed and the kind of people that gravitate towards the desire to accumulate wealth way beyond what anybody needs.
Yeah.
You know, so nobody needs to have a wealth of $25 billion, particularly when there's people starving.
Well, it's just the greed at that point. And
yeah. Yeah. It's some, I don't even know what it is. Some
one thing psychopathology. To have money and care about people, but...
So without unions and without unions pressing the government, because you know what? You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt came from a wealthy family and probably would have ruled as, you know, a wealthy, you know, elite. But at that point, the workers of the United States were on the move. They were, not only were they just striking, they were carrying out general strikes. They called, mm-hmm. They had general strikes in Toledo, general strikes in Milwaukee or Minneapolis, general strikes in Seattle, So they, at some point they said, you know what? We better start buying these people off.
Mm-hmm.
So let's give them a minimum wage. Let's give them Social Security. Let's give them a weekend. Let's give them the right to a teeny bit of countervailing power so they can actually get enough money to create a middle class, and then they can consume. And
right.
Some people thought, you know, this isn't a bad idea for the whole system, because if people have money, they buy.
Yeah.
You know, now they've decided to go the other way. I mean, the Republicans, Reaganomics, all of those people, they know that the system can exist with about a third of well-waged people, and the bottom two-thirds, you know, screw you.
And they're doing it, and they're running
it.
With it.
Yeah. So that was part of, let's get back to Wisconsin. This is Governor Scott Walker gets into office and begins to attack public unions. You know, those awful people, teachers, you know.
Nurses.
Firefighters.
Yeah,
all those
officers.
People. No, he was smart. He actually excluded police officers and firemen.
Oh.
In the first wave, right?
Yeah. But
okay.
Now, yeah.
So they had a big election, and you would have thought that they would have called me.
Well, said, why didn't they?
And said, Pete, do you think this is a good idea? Now, what happened is we brought hundreds of thousands. They would have said, well, Pete, here's the deal. Earlier in the year, we brought hundreds of thousands of people out in the, you know, to protest this attack on labor unions to stop collective bargaining.
And this is Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin. We occupied everything, you know?
Yeah, they did.
And, you know, we were doing it. We've got the power. So we want to get rid of this guy Walker and get somebody back in that, you know, that represents the people. And, you know, Wisconsin really has gone to hell in a... In a handbag? What the hell does that mean?
Handbasket.
Handbasket?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We always wonder about these things. Someone will answer it.
Yeah. But here, how Walker really won Wisconsin, because he won the recall. This is by Jeffrey Summers in Counterpunch, counterpunch.org. One has to understand Wisconsin in order to further appreciate the broader appeal of Walker's message. And he won. Ironically, under the long Reagan revolution that Walker has displayed loyalty to, Wisconsin disproportionately suffered. For example, its urban workers had wages almost 30% over the national average before Reagan took office. Presently, they are under the national average by roughly the similar percentage. So you would think, well, where in the world would Governor Scott Walker get his votes from?
Yeah.
And he won, I think it was 53%. Yeah, 53% to the guy who was running against him, the mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barrett, who got 46%. Something like 38% of union households voted to keep Governor Walker, who was attacking
their jobs.
Their jobs.
I'll never understand it. And there was such a huge push in Wisconsin. But I would assume, as usual, the voting percentages were way down.
No, actually,
general.
No. This,
like, people, what was the final?
I don't know what it was, but they ran out of ballots. They had to Xerox ballots and hand count them. And I
that
mean,
seems, that's
people
a little
really
scary.
Got out and took part in it. And so, I mean, to me, a union person, you know, a lot of things they said, people just don't like recalls, and which is true.
Yeah.
But, you know, if a recall's there, I mean, it would be like Jews voting for Hitler or blacks voting for George Wallace or something like
right.
that. Maybe think, well, wait a minute, you know, I don't want to give Hitler or George Wallace from Alabama, you know, segregationist
right.
all this attention. But if he's on the ballot, I want to get rid of him, you know. So, I mean, so it was amazing. I mean, a lot of it had to do with the money, of course. I think I was saying they didn't come to me and ask me. I would have said, first off, the amount of money that is going to have to be expended on your part, you know, the labor unions, the Democratic Party, it would be better spent letting this go for another year when the elections come up again and use that to, you know, get the vote out then.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like recalls. People think that you shouldn't be recalling people simply because you disagree with them.
Because they got in the first place.
Yeah, they got in legitimately, you know, that the governor of Wisconsin hasn't done anything illegal or corrupt while in office. There's only been three recall votes of governors in the entire history of the United States.
I know,
and two of them were successful, though.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what encouraged them.
Right, right, true.
Yeah.
Well, they couldn't just sit and back and do nothing, Peter.
Well, you
the people of Wisconsin,
you have to wait.
Weren't doing it.
And I would have said, you know what you're going to do? You're going to attract tens of millions of dollars of right-wing billionaire money that is going to put out the right-wing Walker message in a way that hasn't been seen before.
And they did.
So partly, there's two things going on. One, the labor unions and the Democrats just got overwhelmed with money. They were being outspent 7-1. I forgot, I don't know, somewhere in this stuff, maybe you can find it quickly. But, these right-wing billionaires, mostly from out of state, gave this Governor Walker of Wisconsin $45 billion. And I think the Democrats had like 7 or 8 million or something like that.
Millions and millions?
Millions and millions. 45 millions, seven, eight million.
Well, this is how elections are won.
Yeah. And this is all this Republican-sponsored thing called Citizens United that lets corporations and endless money buy elections. So, I mean, they made a real mistake. But one of the things that happened, and so you'd think that, are these people that voted, these working class people, these middle class people that voted to keep Scott Walker, that's attacking their standard of living? Because remember, the unions are the only organized political force that is pushing for decent wages, working conditions, benefits, safety standards, and what
yeah.
have you. Nobody else is. Who else is? And the only reason, if you say, well, some of the Democrats are, the only reason the Democrats do is because they're being pushed by the unions. The unions
yeah.
are, contributing to their campaign.
Sure.
So why? I mean, actually, no Jews voted for Hitler. No blacks voted for George Wallace.
Right.
I mean, maybe 2% of screwballs did or something like that. But
yeah.
but those people
out there.
Knew when they were under attack, and they knew enough not to vote for them. But so why would almost 40% of union families vote for a man that's trying to destroy them?
You tell me.
Well, it's what I always said. It's the party of resentment.
The party of resentment. And is this an example of a combination of low information voting as well? It's got to be.
Yeah. Well, the two of them. One, I mean, getting all this disinformation from the ads that were being run by these outside groups. But
yeah.
what it was that the middle class and the working class have taken so many hits, particularly the ones that aren't unionized. Their pensions have been destroyed.
Yeah.
Their houses are underwater, everything like that. So rather than thinking, you know what? we should be in unions too, because the people that are doing the best in the midst of this recession are the people that have their wage standards and everything else down in writing that they've negotiated with the employer, whether it's the state or whoever. Rather than they say, you know, but it's like, you know, let's take everybody down in the mud. It's resenting people in the same class as them that have it better.
Because of unionization.
Yeah, and that's right. Because if you see every statistic, if you know, if you're in a union, you get higher wages, you get better benefits, the whole deal.
And we know the people who are in unions, and I'm sure there are some out there right now who have frustrations with their own unions and their situations. But that's because cats like Snyder are trying to chip away at your rights and your benefits and everything else involved with it.
Yeah. So that's Wisconsin, and
I was. Very, very disappointed in that.
Well, I was disappointed, but you know what? I was not
surprised.
I was not surprised.
I kind of was. I hate to say it.
Yeah. All right. We'd like to hear your comments. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you. They may be limiting marijuana arrests in New York City.
Limiting, because we know there's a whole lot of them there.
Yeah. So is the nanny state? Well, we'll talk about that.
It.
All right.
Okay.
Give us a call.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. Here are Peter and Jalene.
All right. Thank you very much. And welcome back. Remember our Facebook page too, facebook.com/nightcall.
Yes. And someone had asked us, what happened to the podcast? They're still there. We just were a little delayed last week in getting it. We're going to have it up by noon tomorrow.
That's right.
And also, I want to say someone who will be working on, who will be listening to the podcast, is Jeff in Tokyo. Who wrote in about 4 hours ago, said it was Monday morning in Tokyo, so he's working, and he always looks forward to the podcast. So.
That's right.
Hello.
So
all the way to Tokyo.
We talk about the ZZ Top song, I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide.
Right there.
He's international.
He's one of the ones who makes us international.
That's right. I was going to talk about the mayor of New York is going to limit arrests for marijuana, but I wanted to bring this up. Rebecca from Detroit sent us this information. Remember a few weeks ago we were talking about the so-called nanny state. That's another thing that the Republicans hate. They don't like any restriction on individual liberty. So, like, they want people, anybody to be able to carry a gun, you know,
and what do you mean?
Outside.
It's really kind of, I know what it means, but for someone like nanny,
state?
What do you mean?
A nanny, you know, a nanny is somebody that takes care of kids. And what?
Yeah.
The people that oppose that say is they don't need the government to nursemaid them.
Sure.
So we should be able to buy all the fireworks we want. I mean, I can't wait to see all the fingers and hands that are going to be blown off now that the Republicans have repealed that law.
Yeah.
And remember, they said they wanted to repeal restrictions on the size of knife blades.
Right.
Like
yeah.
All that.
Make them bigger.
Yeah. And
give
of course,
more.
What they were successful in, and I'm surprised that the insurance companies didn't do better with this. They repealed the helmet law for motorcyclists.
Yeah, as I've been driving around, I do notice.
Man, people, I just see this guy roaring in and out of traffic. No.
In and out, scared the out of me.
But fatalities from motorcycle crashes have more than doubled since the mid-1990s. The latest figures show that these accidents take in about 4,500 lives a year, and one in seven of traffic deaths. And yet, you know, you have these groups that are trying to repeal helmet laws. And, you know, at one point, I mean, I have a libertarian streak in terms of controlling personal behavior,
mm-hmm.
like drugs or prostitution or gambling or what have you. It's not to say that a lot of these things don't do harm. I mean, certainly alcohol does harm.
And, yes.
And we know drugs can do harm and what have you. But, we were talking about where do we, at what point do we say, hey, you know, we need government protection? Obviously, working people need protection for wages. That's why there's a minimum wage. They need government regulations for safety standards. Or, as I was saying earlier, these owners would have no safety standards whatsoever.
There would be no such thing as ergonomics.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm looking for... Oh, here
well,
we
basically,
go.
Well, basically, since Michigan passed that law, there have been 3 fatal car accidents. In the first month since passing it, 2 of them were individuals not wearing helmets.
Yeah. And I noticed, though, what's the guy's name? Because I've actually done public service announcements for the group Abate. And where is it? Oh, yeah, Vince Consiglio. He said, whenever you ride, you take a risk, whether you're wearing a helmet or not. Well, that's mm-hmm, true, mm-hmm. You know, and if you were, you know, I don't know, standing up on it, no-handed, you'd be taking a risk. In other words, you can reduce risks. And I think I said when we were talking about this, I rode motorcycles before there was a helmet law, and I always wore a helmet, and I always wore leathers, and saved me.
Yeah.
You know, when I had a crash. And people say, well, that's your choice. I like to feel the wind in my hair.
I would just be too nervous.
Yeah.
I'm nervous with a helmet on motorcycles there.
But the point is that these accidents are socialized, because if you split your head open, maybe you die, you leave a family. And sometimes you leave dependent kids. If you don't have proper health insurance, we're all going to have to pay the cost. So that's the question. I mean, is it just you? It's me, and it doesn't have any effect. It's just my head or my body, or does it actually spread across society? And should we require people to protect themselves? I mean, as I said, the instigator of the helmet law was the insurance companies, mm-hmm. because they're going to start taking a bath again. I mean, it's one thing if someone like. If I wouldn't have had a helmet on, I very well could have been dead today when my head hit the hit the pavement. Mm-hmm. What's the cost there? I mean, say I had kids.
For living.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So there you go.
Yeah, well, that's a hot topic, especially for a lot of the listeners of this radio station who, a lot of them ride cycles.
Feels good. I got to admit that. Yeah. Here, and we'll get to the marijuana thing in a minute. I just saw the first, never get caught up in movements that involve Democrats and Republicans. They blind you. Politics prevail and you get taken, advantage of the hard way. No one man is the be all end all. Just plain old Rick from East Point.
It's just plain old Rick. So
now,
what does that mean?
Tell him what that means though.
That means he's no longer Ron Paul Rick?
Yeah.
He's a regular listener of the show.
Yeah.
And emailer of the show.
calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Yes.
Now, Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul, endorsed Mitt Romney. And the headline in businessinsider.com says, Ron Paul supporters are really pissed.
I'm telling you.
That Rand Paul endorsed Mitt Romney.
Those Ron Paul supporters are going to vote for Romney. I don't care of them say, because there is a particular one who listens to this show named Harold, who's hopefully listening right now, who's decided he's voting for Mitt Romney. I can't even talk to him anymore.
Yeah. Here, we were talking earlier about the recall election in Wisconsin, where the right-wing governor... Scott Walker won, and Raskolnikov. Remember Raskolnikov?
Wait,
it was the character in Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment.
Okay, yeah.
Peter, like you, I was not surprised that Walker won. There's no doubt in my mind that the Wisconsin recall failure is a bellwether, and it logically follows all recent indication that things will need to get much worse before they will get better, if in fact they ever can. We have met the enemy, and it is us.
Hmm.
Who said that?
Who did? Yeah, who did say that?
Pogo.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to do this. Check this out. Xavier, I never like to click on...
Links,
Xavier. So resend it. All right.
We do have a couple calls. I don't know if you checked that.
Period. I haven't. Okay. I've just been... okay, well, let's do that, and then I'll get... I want to go to Mike in Jackson, because this is an excellent question. Mike, hi, you're our first caller. You're on the air. Welcome. You got a great question.
Okay, I'm just kind of confused because voting is on Tuesday in our United States of America, and I think voting should be on Saturdays with same-day registration in our United States of America.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
why not
agree.
Do it on a day when the majority of people have, weekends, one of those rights that we won as a human race here in the country, we should be able to have that off, or it should be a national holiday.
You know what I don't understand, Mike? Why the Democratic Party doesn't push this? Because the people that tend to vote the least are poorer people, and many times they've just worked some bad job for 8 or 9 hours, and they got to go stand in line and choose mm-hmm. between a Democrat and a Republican, It's not the greatest thing in the world to do. You would think not only would it be Saturday, but it should be Saturday and Sunday. Or how about this, Mike? How about this for a better suggestion? Tuesday remains election day, but it's a paid holiday.
Paid holiday.
What do you think?
I mean, that's good. I would still say, let's just go with Saturday. Because people are trying to support families and they can't. It's a Tuesday. And
paid holiday.
Saturday and a Sunday. That's great, Peter. Saturday and a Sunday.
But what about a paid holiday, though?
Well.
Don't push it, Warby.
No, I'm pushing it.
Okay.
Here's what I. Here's,
Saturday, same day registration consistently.
Okay, but here. Okay. This is what you got to do. You always demand the impossible. And then kind of, the man in power will go, well, wait a minute. How about, hey, buddy, can we make a deal? So you say, I want Tuesday and Wednesday as paid holidays to vote. And so they go, whoa, what if we give you Saturday and Sunday? We say, okay, you drive a hard bargain. But what I know, the Republicans are trying to limit the vote. I mean, that's their whole deal is they're trying to make registration as hard as possible, voting as hard as possible.
Yeah, getting to the polls.
Everything. So you would think the Democrats, at least as positioning themselves as a friend of the average person, would say, hey, look, we should have more time to do this. I mean, that really, if you were, say you get off work at 6 o'clock, and then sometimes in big elections, and sometimes again, this is engineered when you got like Republicans running, like the Secretary of State, like in Ohio in 2004 and in Florida in 2000.
Oh, sure.
You got them running the voting booths as well, the whole voting process. So you go there after you've worked, say, 8 hours. You get off at 6 o'clock. You get to where you're supposed to vote in an hour, and there is a line. And this happened in Ohio.
Where they closed
200
it?
Deep.
Yeah, and they closed them, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. No, I think
don't
if
they
you're
have
no,
to
no,
stay
if you're in line,
open?
You can play. But you just worked 8 or 9 hours. And you got to go stand in line for
another two hours.
I don't think
do
so.
Yeah, I mean it's been a long, grueling day. You have kids. You need to get home.
So what do you think? Voting as a paid holiday on Tuesday. By the way, thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it. Tuesday is a paid holiday, or Saturday and Sunday voting. Here's Rick in Farmington Hills. Hey, Rick, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
I was just going to comment on the no helmet law.
Yeah.
You know, ever since that came out, insurance went up.
What? So, motorcycle insurance has?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So if you don't take the time out to protect yourself and put yourself in that danger zone, that's on you. But people don't use common sense anymore, man, and that's sad.
Yeah.
You ride a bike?
I want to ride one. But if I do ride one, you better believe I'm going to have on a helmet. Even if I did want to let the wind blow through my head.
There's other ways to sit in front of a fan.
That's right. So, come on. It's kind of funny, but hey.
Well, part of it, but Rick, part of it is this sense. I mean, one of the reasons that I rode a motorcycle, and you want this sort of sense of freedom and rebellion, and even nobody will admit to it, but even sort of imaging,
It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's a cool image. It's a cool male image. In fact, now it's a cool women's image, too.
Yeah, I mean, did you see my fat boy out back that I rode in on?
You did?
No.
It's cool. You can still be cool with a helmet. You got all these paint jobs you can put on these helmets.
Sure, sure.
Stuff, so, I mean, it's no excuse for it.
Yeah.
Because when you're walking around like a waterhead boy, because you was on the motorcycle, now you ain't got no brain skills. What you want somebody to feel sorry for you?
Yeah. Well, the other thing I remember we were talking about too, Rick. What happens? Okay, so say not you, but someone else. They got a wife and they got three kids, and suddenly, boom, they're gone. You know, or they need extensive medical care. So, on one hand, you have the idea of one's individual freedom, but on the other hand, you and I are picking up the cost. So, I mean, it's a hard thing. All right, Rick, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. You have an excellent one. Thanks for calling. Here is Scott in Westland. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Well, okay. I guess that just since you're talking about, the helmetless rule, it's not that I never used to drive a motorcycle, but back in the day we had this Suzuki 185, which is still in my brother's garage. Okay, and I'm going to honor the passing of a great rock and roll musician, Ronnie Montrose,
Yeah, he did.
So the name of the song is bad motor scooter.
Sure.
Yeah.
Ma'am.
It starts like that.
We don't know well on this station.
West Plant to Ann Arbor, down Getty's Road, you know, on that little 185, you know.
Yeah, it went.
You know, and the man just like that.
That was a two-stroke?
Well, not to get too much deeper into it, but yes, I think somebody from Austin said, you know, another six stringer gone home.
There you go.
I don't know what the hell you guys are talking about.
Yeah, anyway, but listen, we're almost up against a break, so I want to hear about this Ted Nugent scandal. What now?
Oh, well, okay. The thing I'd like to say is that I actually respect Ted Nugent as a rock and roll artist. You know,
sure.
Like I said, you know, people talk about Stranglehold. They're, you know, debating about that. You know, he has some good songs that I like, you know, Motor City Madhouse, you know.
But Scott, we need the headlines. We need the headlines that we're going to have to get to the meat of it.
The thing is that he's hypocrited himself on poaching, okay? He's been busted for poaching.
Yeah, he got in trouble.
In California and Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, see, even if I wasn't a vegan, you know, or whatever, you know, I would be against poaching. We're all against poaching, right? You know, and so the thing is that the least controversial thing about his political agenda is that he's against poaching. And okay, he's violated that, you know.
He did.
You know,
he pleaded no contest.
Right.
Well,
so,
what that means.
So is this a scandal? Yeah, I thought you had a new scandal.
Oh gosh. Well,
you know, he was talking about.
Make something up. Why not?
Yeah, he was talking about just recently about respect for the military and all that. He was just another one of these hippie draft dodgers.
Yeah, he dodged the draft by
not bathing for like 2 weeks
and wearing the same pair of pants and like.
Yeah.
Going to the bathroom in the jeans and then showing up at the draft office where they were like, you're crazy, goodbye.
Yeah, well, but, you know, and then now he's Mr. Military and threatening people and
yeah, they didn't, he was previously going to perform at a base and they said, I don't think so.
Yeah. Remember what I told you last time, though? They told him that they wanted him to leave a urine sample, a stool sample, and a semen sample.
And that's why he did. And so he just left his jeans?
He just left his jeans.
I mean, what a sweetie. The guy's such a sweetie. I mean, you know? And he's actually, like, married, isn't he? Babe's actually like the
Well, there was something, though. He had some scandal with some 17-year-old.
Yeah, and there was that.
Yeah. And he says he never did any drugs, which is total BS.
Well, he should have.
Yeah.
You know, he could have stood a little bit of medical marijuana.
Scott, we got to go. Thank you very much. I thought you had a new one. All right. Okay, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, welcome back to our second hour. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. We have a couple of lines open if you want to call in.
Now, that song we just played was an introduction by a guy that called himself the Reverend Jesse Crawford. And that was recorded live at the old Grandy Ballroom, God, a long time ago, July 31st, 1968, and featured the MC5. And that's Detroit's legendary rock band, and the lead guitarist, Wayne Kramer, is going to be my guest at 1 a.m. Incredible interview, an incredible guy. And he was the lead guitar, and he's going to talk about the history of the band, its breakup, but then his imprisonment for drugs. He got caught with a pound and a half of blow.
My God.
Served 2.5 years in Lexington. And then completely turned his life around. And one of the things he did, he formed this group called Jail Guitar Doors. And one of the things that's weird, Jail Guitar Doors is a song by The Clash. And it was about Wayne Kramer.
Cool.
It's a Wayne's in jail. And what jail, and he'll talk, I'm giving this all away.
That's what the rappers do now. They sing about each other being in jail.
Sure. Yeah. Jail Guitar Doors is a program that gets... music programs and actual instruments into prisons.
Oh, very nice.
So it's very cool. And also Larry Tai, who's been on the show a lot of times, and it's up and away. He's written a book called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. And it's very cool. And Larry Tai will explain to you why Superman is Jewish.
Really?
Yeah.
Never knew.
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
I told him, you'll hear that in the interview. I said, no, I don't know, Larry. I don't know if you've convinced me. You know, I keep saying it. Well, let me just say this real quickly, because I keep promising and never get to it, is that Mayor Michael Bloomberg of
New York City.
Thank you. The cops made about 50,000 arrests last year for low-level marijuana possession. And what they're going to do is they're going to cut that back because they have this stop and frisk. And they just stop, I don't know, do you remember the figure? Something like 500,000 blacks and Hispanics. Mm-hmm. And they just roust them. That used to be called a roust.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, essentially illegal activity by
sure.
the police.
Yeah. No, by the police.
Yeah, yeah. And what they say, they use an excuse, the person was acting furtively. You know, sort of suspicious.
Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, 500,000 times. But so now, and can you imagine what that does to people's lives and what that does to the judicial system?
Yeah.
Of course, what this is and what we always talk about, these are customers for the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, they need to fill those up.
Yeah.
Can't have all that empty space.
Right. Okay. So let's see. Let's get back to our calls. Here's Bob in White Lake. Bob, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing today?
We're good.
Well, you know, I've been kind of following along since I left out of Kalamazoo a few hours ago here.
Okay.
And, you know, I think you're posing an interesting topic with how the rich stack the deck. And, you know, I think the deck stacking goes a bit deeper, at least, you know, on a fundamental level than we look at from the surface. You know, you're talking about kind of real topical stuff, but, you know, the rich have the deck stacked from the property tax on up. They control all of the contracts for the roads. They control all of the contracts for the public services. You know, none of these, you know, you talk about the prison industrial complex, but, you know, what about the road contractors like 6S?
Mm.
What about the large military contractors like Lockheed Martin?
Sure.
What about all the other contractors? I mean, these are wealthy people that are running these corporations. None of these guys are, you know, scraping by to, you know, pay their mortgage every month in a down market. And what they've essentially done is forced us into a form of servitude in a way that we don't really consider very frequently.
Well, what about also all the loans? You know, it's rich people, the rich, essentially loaning money to the classes below them so they can buy houses and buy cars and mm-hmm. Go to college.
Well, that's after they've driven the price up to where you can't afford to buy anything
exactly.
without pulling a loan.
Exactly.
And that's where I'm saying the deck stacking probably goes a bit deeper than any of us is really willing to examine or admit, that the deck is much taller, it's much deeper, and it's much more in depth than we really probably would care to look at. You know, that, you know, what the real Ron Paul revolution was about, and this is, you know, fundamentally what he's talking about, the message underneath of what he's saying, it's rallying kind of, I guess we can call some of these guys mouth breathers. I mean, some of these guys just hear, yeah, you know, more freedom, and they jump on the more freedom, but they really don't understand what freedom is. You know, they don't understand that, you know, freedom isn't owning a house. Freedom is you're free to do as you please, you know, obviously within the limit of you don't hurt or offend or cross
into someone
else's
path. Also being able to
pay
for your own house.
Yeah.
Well, you can't ever own it because if you buy a house, you're taking out a lease on the land underneath of it to the local government.
Through property
tax. You can't
ever
actually own a piece of property in this country because at some point you pay an excise or a fee or a tax or a recurring service charge. And if you fail to pay that, the state will come in and forcibly and with the threat of violence, take your property and your rights.
Well, wait a minute. You got to have property tax. How are you going to pay for city services?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And,
yeah.
And, you know, that's the question is who's stacking the deck to benefit the most from those taxes? And the answer is not the people paying them. You know, the rich, by and large, don't pay a very large portion of taxes. They pay a lot of income tax. But what they don't pay a lot of is the regressive taxes, like property tax. I mean, if you look at property tax as a percentage of value of, say, a $100,000 house in Michigan, you know, a guy with a $120,000 house making $40,000 a year is paying $3,000. But a guy with a $1 million house is paying like $5,000 a year.
Yeah, that's Hedley.
And that's where the disproportionality of the whole thing starts to really show its face, is that the rich have somehow managed to rig the poor into a system where they constantly pay the rich, and the rich control all of the seats of power because they have the money to pour into the elections to buy the candidates they want.
Well, it's the nature of the system. But here is the question. It sounded like you supported Ron Paul. Are you going to vote for Willard Romney?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Who are you going to vote for?
I'll vote for a carrot and a bag of onions first.
All right, Bob. Thanks for calling.
I haven't heard
we
that one yet.
We appreciate it. But this adds to it. This is from what? Just from Reuters. Six American families paid no federal income taxes in 2009 while making something on the order of $200 million each.
Wait.
They each these six
the
families.
The Walton family?
I don't know. You know, it doesn't say here. That's interesting. This is one of the many stunning revelations in the new IRS data that deserves a thorough airing. The data posted on the IRS website last week brings into sharp focus the debate over whether the rich need more tax cuts. That's what Mitt Romney wants. The annual report, which the IRS typically releases with a two-year delay, covers the 400 tax returns reporting the highest incomes in 2009. These families reported, and this is the top 400 tax returns, average income of 202, this is income, folks, income, not wealth, $202.4 million, down for the second year as the Great Recession actually slashed their capital gains, you know, how much they made on stocks and bonds. Now, you remember we were talking about Christy Walton, who was worth, she was worth.
And this is the Walmart family.
Yeah, like $23.7 billion.
God.
And remember, I said you could confiscate, as I would advocate, $23 billion from her, put it back into the general fund to pay for what we're all missing in our cities, and she would be left, and the point seven is $700 million. That's all she would be worth.
What would she do? She'd have to sell her art.
She'd still have enough money to buy art. with these people, it'd be, I guess, the 0.4 million would just be $400,000. It's not much. Or is that right? Yeah. In addition to the six who paid no tax, another 110 families paid 15% or less in federal income taxes. That's the same federal tax rate as a single worker who made $61,000 in 2009. And it goes on like that. So, let me see. This comparison illustrates how Congress has created two income tax systems, separate and unequal, burdening millions much more heavily than the few, those with gigantic incomes and a propensity to make campaign contributions that's what Bob was just talking about. This maintains the system as it is. One system is for wage earners and pensioners whose taxes are withheld from their checks. This rigorous, efficient tax system taxes them fully. The other system is for business owners, executives, managers of hedge and private equity funds, name brand athletes and entertainers, and many others with huge incomes. Congress lets them put unlimited amounts of income in sheltered accounts and put off paying taxes for years or even decades. So it's an enormous racket. And you know what? I don't think anyone's even shocked to hear this news.
No.
Maybe the details or the extent of it or how large it is or the fact that that many families are, you know, you're paying taxes and somebody makes $200 million, they're not paying anything. And you go, yeah, you know, the rich get that. I mean, a few of you people that have just really, you know, the vampires have sucked you dry. You go, well, it's their money. You've just given up.
Now, what was it? I think you sent me something about one of Obama's people said that he's not going to continue the Bush tax cuts to the rich.
Obama is not.
Yes.
I didn't send it, but that would be good.
Yeah.
I mean, they got to raise the taxes on the rich because, I mean, the idea that, here's the Republican, I mean, I can't even believe they believe this, that if you cut more taxes on the ultra wealthy, then they will create more jobs. Has that worked?
No, it never works.
It hasn't worked. It didn't work. It isn't working.
So and, keep trying to convince people of it.
And the other thing is, if you, and they want to roll back regulations, like on the financial industry, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
just,
sure.
Let them do whatever they want. Yeah,
hey,
what the hell.
You know, roll back all the, while you're at it, roll back all of those environmental regulations.
Sure.
I mean, coal, they keep telling us on those commercials it's clean, Peter.
Well, so in many ways, it's a double tax break for the rich. They're going to lower their taxes, and they're going to take off regulations, because one of the reasons that these like utility companies argue to keep poisoning all of us mm-hmm. with what they're putting out their smokestacks or whatever they're doing, their industrial facilities, is because it costs them money to be environmentally sound, or not even though sound, I don't know if they can get there, but better. They can stop, you know, causing, in order to cost them money to stop creating asthma in our kids. And they don't want to spend the money. They want to poison our kids. And that's why what I was saying earlier.
They don't want to, they just don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was saying earlier. If capitalism had begun as a cooperative enterprise, understanding that some people would manage and other people would work,
mm-hmm.
and the workers and community people would go and say, do you realize that next to your factory, you have this enormous rate of childhood asthma, and it's being caused by what's coming out of your smokestack?
Mm-hmm.
In a human system, the owner would go, oh my God. What are we going to do?
Yeah,
we got to go find the best anti-pollution equipment available and put that on immediately.
And that doesn't happen.
No, instead you have the Koch brothers, the KOCH, but aptly named on lots of different levels. They are going to pump money into Republicans that are going to vote to reduce environmental standards.
Yeah, so kids are going to get cancer.
Yeah, and more kids are going to get asthma. More kids are going to get cancer
Yeah.
So they can make more money.
How many times do we hear about these cells or pockets of, you know, areas that are near the big power towers and things like that?
Industrial map, cancer map.
Yeah.
Industrial map, asthma map.
Right,
On and on, like that, yeah. And I don't understand how, how there's any of you that, I don't understand how the rich, you know, if, because you would think people would still have a conscience, would carry on in this manner, how anybody who isn't in the 1% would do anything other than devote their life to dispatching these people out of positions of power and create a human system that functions more cooperatively, more democratically, that gets big money out of everything, that relieves a lot of these people with this wealth that they don't even need, where there's so many other aspects of life in our states and our cities and our schools and our roads that need the money.
Other than
what's
the fact
up with that?
People are busy. People don't pay attention. I mean, it's just such a small percentage of people who actually, on a regular basis, pay attention to the deep facts of what's going on out there.
Here is, I'm sorry, I don't have a name up here, but they want to speak about voter registration. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hey, this is Mike from Fenton.
Hi, Mike.
The voter registration, but yeah, you're right. It's crazy about these rich people wanting. The fellow that was talking before, you know, he's talking about how they're doing all this stuff. One of the things that really bugs me every month is when I get my gas bill and they're charging me $10 on the gas bill and $10 on the electric bill for the privilege of using it, and it's cost the Michigan about $45 million a month to give them before we're even paying anything on our gas. And they say that's to do the help with whatever, but 10 months, you know, what's that figure out to? You're talking about almost $600-700 million a year that they're stealing from us, and we're not getting nothing for it. But I wanted to talk about the voters registration.
Sure.
It's what we need to do is we need to have it to where either they give us a break on when we get our license or our tags, or when we go to pay our taxes, that we get, you know, whatever it is, $20, $50, $100 credit for voting. So if you vote, then you'll get your $100 credit. That way we can get a real vote on what the people really want to vote on, not just a few or, you know, this fly by the wayside thing the way it's going now. We need to have people vote, and there needs to be an incentive, and the government needs to you know, have it to where people want to vote.
You know what? I mean, I understand your motivation, but the fact that we actually have to bribe people
right.
to defend their interests, I don't know.
We have to do something because we need to get, you know, because what we need is to get the people to vote because the rich people, they're banking on that the people are too busy. They're not going to do it. They're going to stay in control. If we could get everybody to vote, everything would change because people don't think like these people do and things would start to change, but they got to vote and they're not.
Well,
definitely got to get more people to the polls when the average is about 30% or lower, the population that goes.
Yep. There's a suggestion. Thank you for it. I appreciate it. Here our weekly, I've just started calling it this tonight. I didn't
you
even
did?
Tell you the Armed Madhouse Report. At least three people were killed, including two former Auburn University football players in a shooting in an apartment complex near the campus in Auburn, Alabama, the police said, in a fight that the local news media reported may have started as a dispute over a woman. Chief Tommy Dawson of the city of Auburn said that in addition to the three killed, three others were wounded in the fight, which happened at an off-campus housing complex. Two of the people who were wounded, including Eric Mack, a third-year offensive lineman on the Auburn football team, were expected to recover. Another was listed in critical condition with a gunshot wound to the head. See, if everybody would have been armed, though.
They'd all be dead?
They probably all would be.
Right. Yeah. All over a woman? That's crazy.
Yeah. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Peter and Jolene.
Hello.
Good morning to you.
Okay. Now, before I get on you about a word you used earlier, I just wanted to say, you know, off and on, you've been hearing rich people talk, well, I should say conservatives, talk about how the rich pay, you know, 47% of all taxes. But what the Democrats or what any liberal needs is to find somebody somber they can stick on TV and pretty much tell the entire nation in 30-second or one-minute spots, hey, yeah, they may pay 45, 47% of all taxes, but they've devastated everybody else to such a point where, well, that's how they end up paying so much.
Yeah, and Romney wants to give the banksters more freedom.
Right.
What I did, you know, I keep forgetting. Somebody was telling me, somebody ran up to me and told me, oh, yeah, that I was always using is when I should be using were. Like he said, you wouldn't say if I, wait a minute, if I, if,
you do?
Was and were, yeah. He said, you wouldn't say if I was a carpenter. I said, yeah, I would. But then I remember the song as if I were. Anyway, what word was I using
Uh-oh.
Wrong? Probably another
well,
one.
No, well, earlier, just that I heard you, I think you mentioned the voter, the People United ruling as a mistake.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't consider that a mistake, just like I don't consider the voter obstruction they're trying now as a mistake.
Oh,
you
they're
know
doing
what a mistake
it on purpose.
Is? A genuine honest mistake was letting Lehman Brothers fall, for instance, because a bunch of rich guys in crisis didn't quite know how to react when they were trying to hold that small group of management accountable.
Uh-huh.
Now that was a mistake. But things like anti-union sentiment by the middle class, that's all willful spite and blind allegiance to conservative so-called values.
Yeah, I agree.
There's
a
lot of blind allegiance.
But Fred, wasn't I saying that? And I was saying that it was just all based on resentment. You know, the other, you know what?
You were saying that, yeah.
Yeah, but you know what's curious? I mean, a couple of things over the last few weeks, and you're a regular listener and you call in a lot, so you remember this. We say we want somebody to call us up and tell us, since the Republicans are blaming, Obama for, all this current situation, and, you know, people's memories don't go back too far. So a lot of people may be saying, yeah, you know, things still kind of suck. And but what their program is, how Mitt Romney would create jobs, I don't hear any of that.
Or anyone. Just name a way.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I said earlier, and I guess you were listening to that segment, where I said without a union of wage earners, so we don't just use it as a proper noun, what chance at all does an individual by themselves against the power of capital, against an employer, have to get better wages? Or, I mean, what if all of a sudden in a, well, I mean, there's laws, of course, but I mean, the Republicans want to repeal those, particularly the libertarians. They think if someone says you're going to work 14 hours and we're taking down all mm-hmm. the safety, standards at mm-hmm. our, then you should be saying, oh, well, I'm going to go work somewhere else. And so it should be the market that determines that. I mean, what a bunch of nonsense.
Well, you know who the middle class remind me of?
What?
The Germans who allowed themselves to be talked into a Second World War by picking the wrong political side.
Well, you know what? There's a lot of mythology about Germany. First, and I've mentioned this any number of times, the last free election, the Nazi Party got like about a third of the vote. The left-wing vote of the communists and the socialists was over 50%. But talk about, on one hand, the Nazis having this will to power and the socialists and the communists who couldn't pull pour horse crap out of a boot if the instructions were on the heel, you know. And then once the Nazis got in and controlled the state, people didn't have much of a chance.
That's true.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult really to assess what kind of widespread support. I mean, certainly with, you know, all the trappings of nationalism and restoring glory and all that, there probably was a lot more people that got on board. But it was the kind of thing, you know, here, you know, I can say, you know, Romney's a jerk. I can say Obama's a jerk. If you say Hitler's a jerk, you know, you never heard of me again, right?
Right.
Yeah. So it's tough. All right, Fred, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks,
right.
Fred.
You have a good night. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Could this be, Jerry
what?
Writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Yeah, I didn't know if.
Ted Nugent wants to marry his adopted daughter.
Now, is this true?
I mean, it was good enough for Woody Allen.
I know.
I mean, we can't. I mean, we love
and then
Woody.
They had babies together.
They did?
Yeah.
What was her
they
name?
Had two kids.
Sunny
Previn.
Yeah, yeah.
Sunny Previn.
Previn?
Mm-hmm.
Was she any relation to Andre Previn?
I don't know.
Who was a composer?
I don't know. Possibly.
Well, did we? We didn't talk about this. I thought this was.
Although I don't think that she would have been adopted by Woody Allen if she had been, you know, related to someone famous. But then I couldn't.
Why not? Yeah. Why would she? Oh, you mean why would she need to be adopted?
Yeah.
Why would she have a name Previn?
I don't know.
I don't know. That's not a very. She was Korean, right?
I don't know.
Or is.
I don't know. I don't know.
I thought you knew all this stuff about popular culture. I know none of it.
I quit watching TV. I think I've lost a lot of it.
Yeah, you don't watch, what is it, Entertainment Tonight?
I don't watch anything.
Boys, I don't get it.
I mean, you don't get those shows, is what
I
you're saying.
I don't get those shows.
You
yeah.
get that I don't watch television.
You know, yeah, I don't, I've never been a big fan of anything about the inside of
a celebrity's
entertainment.
Life.
Even rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know? Wayne Kramer. The MC5, who I'm going to interview, I have
about
a recorded
a
interview about a half an hour. So he asked me, did I read the Keith Richard book from the...
I actually really want to read that.
I don't know. I just...
I'll give you the highlights.
Yeah. I don't
you
know.
Read a lot, though.
I read a lot, but I mean, and I might be listening to one of the bands, but I mean, I never... They say, you know, see, part of these stories is, you know... When I was 9 years old, my dad bought me a guitar from Sears, and you go, chuckle, chuckle, because you know he's going to wind up to be Eric Clapton or something
right.
like that, you know. Or they say, and our first band was the Mumble Pukes, you know, and you go, ha, 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 because you know they wound up to be Soundgarden
or
something. Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't find it very interesting.
Okay.
But some people do, so I'm not.
Yeah, sure. They sell a lot of books.
Yeah. Can't remember his name. I just read a book set in northern Michigan, a woods cop, a Michigan Department of Natural Resource cop.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, all filled with
so
murder,
that was interesting.
Murder and intrigue. Oh, yeah, it was like
really?
Detective fiction.
You'd rather read that than something about a rock star?
Oh, I love detective fiction.
Oh, I just don't like fiction, so.
Really?
Yeah, not at all. Yeah.
I always read detective stuff. Walter Mosley, although he didn't like it when I said he was a black detective fiction writer. He said, I'm a fiction writer.
Well, there you go, yeah. Peter. You were putting them in a box.
But it's all set, always in, like, it's in the ghetto of L.A. He did, Devil with a Blue Dress.
Yeah.
Not the Mitch Ryder song.
Yeah, right.
With a movie with, I don't know. What's the guy? I can see him.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Clint Eastwood?
No. African-American actor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, and then Tony Hillerman, who mm-hmm. has all these novels, crime novels set on the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Those are fabulous.
Yeah. Don't like
are
them.
Are we on the air?
I do not like them.
Yeah.
They bore me.
All right. Let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. It's Rick in East Point. Rick.
Just Rick.
I heard that. Oh, no, Keith.
Oh, sorry.
It's just Rick.
That's okay. Yeah, it's just. It's no. Well, Linda LaRouche, Rick, now.
What?
Cause.
No.
The what?
No. I'm kidding.
Yeah, don't. We don't want to repeat
that's
this.
A good thing to say. Okay. But anyways, I'll tell you what. I got duped.
What do you mean you got duped?
Well, you were a lot of things.
By Ron Paul?
You get into a movement and you put the blinders on.
Yeah.
And you refuse to see the criticism or the negativity that, hey, look out for this, watch out for this. You can't see it because you're so involved in the good things about a movement. Okay? Paul had a lot of good things.
The 50% that's good.
I didn't know about the School of Americas. I didn't know about American intervention. It made me sick to when I heard about all this. Ron Paul exposed this to me. I turned into an America hater. I liked Reverend Wright what he said in that goddamn America speech. I think it was his best speech ever. There was nepotism in his campaign. There were Benedict Arnolds. There were traitors in his campaign. And even after they knew it was a done deal, they kept asking us for money. They kind of preyed on us away. And I don't think it was so much Ron Paul. I think it was his management. Just like his racist newsletters, okay, which I know he did not write. He was not at the helm of Ron Paul Incorporated, okay? He let other people run his stuff, and he went out and made his speeches.
And that was pretty dumb.
Huh?
Well, no, you can't. I don't. You can't really. Almost can't help that. But politics is a dirty, ugly business the way it's practiced in this country for sure.
Please let me tell you. You that
stressed.
Old thing. Politics makes strange bedfellows. This guy that ran Ron Paul's campaign, Jesse Benton. Okay, he was living with this woman. He was Rand Paul's campaign manager. He, within 7 months, seduced Ron Paul's granddaughter, became that. No, this is the bad story. This is serious.
Quit laughing, Peter.
Sorry.
He seduced Ron Paul's granddaughter.
Wait, how old's the granddaughter?
She looks like she's in her mid-20s.
Okay, oh, good,
okay.
Good,
so
good,
she's
good.
Not a minor. Okay,
let's get that out there.
Still naive.
Wait a minute. Let's look at the language here, right? I mean,
did I swear?
Huh?
No, you did not.
No, you didn't swear. I said, let's look at you say he seduced her. I mean, that sounds like something from the 1930s.
Let me tell you.
I want to hear this.
Let me tell you. Okay, this guy was Rand Paul's manager. He was an establishment Republican guy. Okay, he was hooked up with all these interventionists, all these people that Ron Paul hated. Okay, he seduced his granddaughter. He ended up within 7 months of meeting her, married her. Okay, then all of a sudden this guy is Ron Paul's manager and he's making $500,000 a year. The money that we gave him. Okay,
well, that's something to consider. I'm just saying that.
Not only that.
This is good. Let
him
go.
Yeah, go
Peter.
Ahead. Go.
I'm enjoying the hell out of this.
Not only that, there was about six other of family members, okay, that were on the payroll, okay? Now,
I could never hire any of my family members because they're all Republicans.
Rick.
Well, too bad for you then.
Rick,
well,
Rick,
believe you me,
Rick,
honey.
Where'd you find out all of this?
Peter, for 4 years. Every night I would glean any little information I could about Ron Paul, okay, and sometimes try to, back him up, just, to try to prop them up when some negative stuff come up or whatever.
We know.
Not even really looking objectively at what the other side was saying. This is what I talk about when I say about getting caught up in movements. Okay, you're blinded. Okay. Anyways, so this Jesse Benton guy, he then brings in this fella that is this interventionist, this guy sparking interventionist in the sense of meddling in other nations' affairs. He must be a CIA guy. I swear to God, you know, interventionist, stirring up revolutions in other nations. And the guy, weird name, Treve Olsen, something like that.
Wait a minute.
An interventionist guy.
You know what? Let me, Rick, hold on one sec. Two things. One, we're right up against a commercial break, which we have to take.
We're glad that you've come around.
And the other thing, well.
In 1 week.
On the other hand, finding out things
that
like this.
You've been duped?
Is, and that was his word. But the things aren't as they appear. I mean, that's why I like more citizens' movements that have the capacity to define themselves. Not to say that they can't go wrong. It's not to say they can't be corrupt or what have you. But, I mean, as you wrote, I'm putting your eggs all in one basket of a politician for the mainstream party is always dangerous. But do this, and this is, right now I have you faded down, so no, but I'm going to fade you back up. I need two summary sentences, and then I have to go to break.
And write the rest.
Go. write me, send me some links. Don't go back into the story.
The campaign knew that it was a done deal, yet they still kept taking our money, and Ron Paul was not really in charge of it. If he got to be president and put people like that in his administrations, okay, just think about that. If he wasn't paying attention and put people into charge of, things and they did all the nepotism and all the back scratching and played politics.
Well, I'll tell you, I was never convinced necessarily that anybody with what appears to be a radical platform, that is to say, the disengaging the military from all over the world, if he ever would have gotten office, I'm never even sure he would have done it. But I gotta go. Send me some links. So just plain old Rick from East Point.
I like
appreciate it. All right. We'll be right back. I want to get Greg. He's calling from Tallahassee, Florida. Oh, yeah. The Devil in the Blue Dress. The star was the amazing Denzel Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Who was
That's right.
the hero. Easy Rollins. Great read. Read of the Walter Mosley books. And caller Mick says Mia Farrow adopted and Woody Allen adopted their daughter. Was Mia Farrow. Yeah, because she was so pissed because when he finds out that, Mia finds out that Woody's boinking is their adopted daughter.
Yeah.
Why are you looking so blank?
Well, yeah, they adopted, Mia, but they were married.
No, they didn't adopt Mia.
No, Mia, they adopted the child together.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, but then Woody starts doing her.
Well, I know.
He seduced her, to use Rick's, I mean, I don't get what I was talking about with him.
Hell?
He said that the Ron Paul guy seduced Ron Paul's granddaughter, then married her. That's not called seducing.
Well, he may have. He may have seduced her.
Seduced. I mean,
put on the Mac pretty heavy.
I mean, but that's like a 1920s term or something.
Well, he was being polite.
Yeah.
He could have said something else.
Your thoughts, and we'll go down to Tallahassee, man. That's in the Panhandle. Isn't it?
Somewhere down there, yes.
They're flooded.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. It's our final segment, so get in at 313-298-WRIF at 1 a.m., which is in about 20 minutes. My interview with MC5 guitarist Wayne Kramer. What a life this man has had.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, more here. Whoa, wait a minute. This is disappearing. About Mia Farrow was married to Andre Previn, who was a composer.
Oh!
And they adopted the daughter, not Woody. Woody was just banging her with a Woody.
Oh, gross.
Yeah. Those stars.
Oh, man.
Let's see. Caller Mixes, Mia Farrow adopted, and Woody Allen and then Woody Allen adopted. I don't know, man.
Yeah, like a stepdad adopted.
Who cares?
Why are we even talking about it?
Here's Greg in Tallahassee, Florida. Greg, hi, you're on the air. You're getting some rain down there, huh? Hey, Greg?
Yeah.
I mean, is this the one where you got to click the button to
again.
Get them on?
Yeah, again. Yeah.
Greg, hello? Hi, now you're on the air. Hi, my fault. You're on the air.
We don't have a lot of rain here. It's mostly in southern Florida.
Southern? Anyways, where's Tallahassee? What part of the state?
That's up by Alabama. A lot of people want to change the capital down in southern Florida, you know?
Yeah.
They don't like rednecks. Anyways, I'm not a redneck. I'm from Detroit. And,
right on.
I'm a master carpenter, and I really chuckle every time I hear these libertarians talk about this, that, and the other. But they don't have anything to offer. Like being a master carpenter, I could actually build a wooden wagon wheel. If we got thrust back into the 18th century, I could build wagon wheels and all this.
We're calling you.
Hello?
We're going to call you then when we need the wagon wheel.
Yeah, but like libertarians, they always have this rap about, their rap is basically the same as everybody else. It's leveraged capitalism. They don't know how to fix anything. I can fix anything in my house. I can fix the plumbing, a roofing leak. I can build a house from the ground up.
Well, that's important, and that means that's where politics is not very important, because what ultimately we need is work. People that can make life, can create what we need.
People that can actually produce something.
Yeah.
And like your average libertarian, I don't want to stereotype all of them. Most of them, they don't know how to do anything.
All of them or anything.
You know, they're talking about the free market and all this stuff. They don't have anything to offer to the free market except leveraged, you know, collateralized, blah, blah, blah. But anyways, I don't want to talk about that, but, you know, you were talking about Ted Nugent.
Right.
He doesn't, not doing drugs.
Right.
Well, I used to hang out at the Grandy in the 60s, and I don't think Ted Nugent ever did drugs because he was a right-wing ideological asshole back then. I used to talk to him.
Really?
Well, they had the Amboy Dukes, the band he was in. They had a house called the Duke's House, and if he wasn't doing drugs, he was the only one in the house that wasn't.
He was a great. No, I knew a lot of people that didn't do drugs back then. You know,
really.
But he was and he still is a phenomenal guitarist.
Yeah.
But he's a right-wing asshole.
There he
is. All right, bye.
Okay, bye bye. Yeah, you'll have to call us back and tell us how you really. Now Tallahassee, man, they're getting like the floods.
Are you sure?
Yeah, Tallahassee's up in the Panhandle, what they call the Panhandle.
Of it's by Alabama, didn't you hear?
Yeah.
Maybe not anymore.
Remember, you know, how fast we these people spin through public notice.
What, the news?
But remember all those Republican candidates that they had?
Oh, sure. I mean, the circus, remember?
Michelle Bachmann.
Oh, yeah.
Herman Cain.
Oh, where's he been? Oh, he's probably out on a speaking tour.
No, he is now going to host a nationally syndicated daily talk show beginning in January.
Like, we need another.
Well, one of these right-wing creatures, Neil Bortz, is retiring after doing this for 45 years or something.
Oh, sounds 40, like someone else I know.
42 years. And so old Herman Cain's going to step in. He, you know, they thought, wow, man, maybe he'll be he'll be the presidential candidate, but then all these women started coming out of the woodwork.
Oh yeah, he had a little problem keeping it inside.
Yeah, he did.
Don't get married.
And I mean,
that's my advice.
And it was funny; he was so popular. Remember when they were asking him, "What was it? What do you think about Libya?"
Oh yeah. Then he paused and he took a deep breath and
he kept.
and he had nothing.
No, he didn't.
We'd like to have someone in charge who has at least a grasp of you know, what's going on in the world.
Did we talk about The Exorcist? The guy,
I think
the,
so.
We did last week?
Perhaps.
The guy who wrote The Exorcist is now, no, he didn't. The author of the novel, The Exorcist, was made into a movie way back when, in the 70s mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. He's going to sue Georgetown University because they allowed the Health and Human Services Secretary, Kathleen Sebelius, to speak on campus.
I don't get it.
Well, you would think you wouldn't. He said the last straw was the university allowing students to invite Sebelius to speak in May, considering she was instrumental in helping President Obama draft health care reform that includes a mandate for some religious institutions to offer insurance to cover employees' birth control.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So he wants to control women's bodies.
Yeah.
Hey, there aren't many righties in Hollywood, so.
The suit is going to be filed with the Vatican and the Archdiocese of Washington, asking the church to remove Georgetown's right to call itself Catholic, according to the Cardinal Newman Society, which Blatty, and Blatty is William Peter Blatty, the author of The Exorcist.
I think these people might want to just be quiet. The Catholic Church needs to,
This guy is exercised about that they invited a government official. The students, the university didn't, right? It was the students that mm-hmm. wanted to hear, I don't know why. Have a speaker, yeah. And Georgetown is what produces all these policy wonks and people that are in government. So, you know, I can understand why they'd want somebody like that. But there's a few scandals going on in the Catholic Church. Been going on for a little bit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and they keep coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah, and there was this one. Didn't I read this? This telegenic American priest, widely known for his media commentary from Rome on popes, prayer, and personal morality, has publicly acknowledged having an affair and fathering a child. Whew. At least it's with a woman, right?
Well, hey.
Yeah, and it's
he's trying to change it up a bit.
Yeah, and so that, you know, so that's kind of, you know, a little elevating. It's not a child, and it is somebody of the opposite sex because you know they're not big on homosexuality.
Yeah,
and it says that this is the latest jolt to hit his scandal-ridden, scandal-torn religious order, the Legionnaires of Christ. The priest, the Reverend Thomas D. Williams, apologized in a statement on Tuesday for this grave transgression and to everyone who is hurt by this revelation. He said he would take a year off from the public ministry to reflect on his transgressions and his commitments as a priest.
Think how hot it was. That's what he's going to be thinking.
Yeah, a decision, he said. I know a number of ex-priests and nuns.
Yeah, who've married.
Yeah.
Each other.
I mean, which weird. I mean, I never wanted to say, like, well, you know,
how'd this happen?
Anyway, never mind. None of my business.
Because you really don't want to know.
Yeah. Most of these people are right wingers. These people I'm thinking of are religious liberals. Father Williams was the most visible American member of the Legionnaires, a powerful and conservative Roman Catholic religious order that has been in turmoil since 2006 when its charismatic founder was banished by the Vatican to a life of prayer and penance. The order's founder, a Mexican priest named Degollado died in 2008 amid revelations that he had sexually abused young seminarians, misappropriated money, and fathered several children. So he was going every which way.
Oh my gosh.
Some of whom say they were also victims.
And that's fine, and his children,
what, to sexually abuse kids?
No, it's fine to go every which way. Not with kids.
Yeah,
I mean, be bisexual, do what you want.
Yeah.
Who cares?
And he sexually abuses children. Only last Friday, the Legion acknowledged that seven of its priests are being investigated by the Vatican in connection with the sexual abuse of minors.
It's truly the never-ending story. And then what was the one with that, the megachurch? Yeah, was it Georgia? The guy?
Yeah, that guy. I just saw him. I mean, he claims he was falsely arrested. He was punishing his child, and he said he was slapping her and choking her. And he said that there's no basis to... it at
story.
All. I mean, you know, we'll see. He said there's no marks on her, you know, there's nothing, you know. I mean, then I don't know what the deal is now. I mean, if you're, did you see there was this film, some councilman like in, it was a YouTube video or somehow it got on, you know, went viral. This father is playing ball with his kid. Catch? Oh, you know, isn't that?
You mean like baseball?
Yeah, isn't that sweet? You know, little,
sure.
But you know, and then the kid misses, and the father starts beating the kid with a belt.
Wow.
You know?
And that is, I mean, really, some people really should just not have children.
And I had to look away. I was on the news tonight.
I couldn't even stay. No. I couldn't.
And the family is all standing behind. We believe.
Is that local?
No, it's California. We believe in corporal punishment.
Whatever. You're teaching, you believe in violence. You're teaching your children violence.
And you know what? He didn't commit any transgression, to use their phrase in the last story. He missed the ball.
Yeah, and that's going to happen. He's also teaching his kid that you can't make mistakes and that you can't learn from your mistakes.
Yeah.
And now this kid's going to grow up and beat his kids for, you know, missing that basketball hoop or whatever.
Well, they may be indicting this father. But, you know, that gets back to it. I mean, I don't, like I say, I don't know, can you... What can you do to your kids? I mean, because that used to be fairly common. You know, I mean, a lot of beating.
I got spanked when I was a kid.
Oh, don't go there.
I did. They put me behind this gate in my room, like this little wooden. I'd have to sit there and I remember.
You mean after you got spanked?
Yeah, and they'd stick me in my room.
Not on your bare bottom.
No, I don't think so. Gosh, maybe that's repressed. Maybe that's part of my issue. No, I don't have issues. But, you know, I just don't think it's the best thing to do. But that's a whole other story. That's like an Oprah, even though she, does she have a show anymore?
Somewhere. Doesn't she have
her own network?
Yeah, yeah. She has her own network.
I can't stand it. And I was at the convenience store the other day, and I heard this woman, her daughter, I mean, yeah, the kid was annoying as hell. I mean, honestly, mommy, 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 mommy. And I wanted to go smack her, you know, but I mean, just in my head. And she says, I'm going to smack you. And I thought, oh, God, if you do that while I'm in here, I'm going to melt into the floor. Please don't do it, you know.
So what happened?
The little girl kept going, mommy, mommy, mommy. It didn't make any difference. I don't know.
But she didn't smack her.
No, she didn't. I would have been crushed. I just don't think it's cool.
Yeah, I don't know. You smack a kid for crying? I don't know. That's kind of weird.
It seems pretty backward ass.
Let's get some final calls. Here's Ed from Taylor. Ed, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, Pete. You know, I know you're talking about unions and you know how that's changed and wages go down in that.
Yeah.
But you know, another thing to me that they're doing really big time is this deal where they want to turn everything government private, where they want to take government money.
Yeah.
And then they want to use it to, you know, have a private business run it, from like HMOs to the post office.
Sure.
Social Security.
Social Security, yeah.
They want to get rid of anything government, you know?
Well, the reason, of course, they want to do it is, you know, there's two reasons. One, if they privatize stuff, like everything from, as you say, the post office to schools and everything else, then they turn it over to their corporate buddies, and they can, instead of having to pay people middle class wages, $38,000, $45,000, $50,000 and up like that, and benefits, they'll just pay people, you know, $8, $9 an hour. The other thing is, the unions are the backbone of the Democratic Party, and if they destroy the basis of federal and state and local employment, they'll also destroy all that. So it's all pretty calculated.
Yeah, and it seems like what will happen is these companies will take all the extra money, and then the wages will go down, and then the companies will take the, you know, they'll take all the extra.
Yeah, well,
you know, the government won't save any money. You know, the taxpayers won't save any money. It'll just go to the businesses instead of the workers.
Sure, because what happens when you employ, like, for instance, these private prisons, the guards there that aren't unionized, you know, and usually the guards are state employees and have, you know, public sector unions. But when you get these private prisons that are costing states a fortune, they have guards working for $10 and $11 an hour.
Yeah.
And you can imagine they're probably going to act out a little as well. Yeah. I mean, that's what's ahead of us. And if we don't unite against that, what my favorite phrase, we might as well just get a bunch of thatch, put it on our roofs and admit we're peasants. I think that's about what it's going to be about. Those are our choices. All right, Ed, I got to wrap it up. We got a show.
We have interviews coming up at 1 a.m. We'll be back for a live show next Sunday. And we have a podcast available tomorrow or today.
Let me just tell you quickly. Why can't I seem to find anything? I can remember it. Yeah, my guest coming right up will be Wayne Kramer, the former lead guitar of the MC5, who now does incredible film and documentary scoring, does music for ESPN. Also, Larry Tye, who says at one point, kind of surprised me, said Superman is Jewish.
This is just out of left field, you know?
Yeah, really.
But then again, so is our show.
I said, what? You know, how could that be? And I think I say on the interview, I don't know, Larry.
Did he convince you by the end
no,
of it?
No, not at all. I mean, the guy was from Krypton.
Right, exactly. Well, maybe we don't know everything about Krypton.
Well, the what is it? The diaspora, the spreading of people across the world. Maybe went pretty far afield.
I guess so.
All right. Let's thank our friends in the other room.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Athena, so much for answering our phones and getting our podcast together. We appreciate it.
Yeah, and they'll be in
11 hours.
Today, at noon today.
Yep.
We got it all good. All right.
Let's call Jaleen. It a day, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jaleen Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jaleen are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
You guys just thrive on pushing the limits.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Ah, that's the sweet spot.
The Riff.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, it's up, up, and away times, folks. And that means Superman, right? It's a cultural icon, the man of steel, the truth, what was it, truth, justice in the American way. I mean, that's just almost become a cliche. And most of us know the story, or do we? I'm willing to bet probably, since Superman has faded a little bit, although there's a comeback in the works, that the story of Superman probably isn't riveted in your mind. Certainly not the backstory of Superman. It's incredible. Joining me is Larry Tye. He's been on this broadcast any number of times. He has a new book about Superman. And previously, I've interviewed him about, in fact, one of my favorite interviews that I've played a couple of times, Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. That's Satchel Paige, the great African-American fastball pitcher. Also, there's another excellent book called Rising from the Rails about the porters on the guys on the railroads. There was just an incredible story of civil rights as well. And also with Kitty Dukakis, he wrote the book called Shock. And now the new one is Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Larry Tye in his office in Lexington, Massachusetts. So it's up, up, and away. Larry Tye, welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Peter.
Well, the obvious thing is, why is there so much about Superman? With, you know, the comics are real thin little things and all that, but you've got this big book. You've interviewed 300 people. You've gone through all these magazine articles. You've watched television series and movies. What beguiled you about the Superman story?
So there's a serious part of what interested me and drew me to this story, and the serious part is I'm really intrigued about heroes and why Americans embrace the heroes that they do. That was what drew me to Satchel Paige. It's what's drawn me to my next book, which is a biography of Robert Kennedy. And I decided that the best way to understand America and its heroes was to look at the longest-lasting hero of the last century. And that wasn't a politician, and it wasn't a sports figure. It was, or at least I argue in this Superman book, that it was Superman who was brought to life 74 years ago and looks like he'll last another century. And that was a serious side. It was a lens into America and what our heroes tell us about us. The fun side of it was I wanted to be 10 years old again, and no better way to be 10 than to go back and play with Superman.
Well, as I said, there's two stories really here. I didn't say there was two stories. I said there was a backstory. But the first story is the story of Superman himself and how he arrives on Earth and his exploits and all that. And the other is the creators. Give us just a quick reminder about Superman. And I'd be surprised how many people, well, I guess they know, everybody knows he came from Kryptonite because the planet was dying. And I'm not even sure I remember what they sent him off, his His father was, see, I am forgetting. What was his father's name? Jor-El, was it?
His father's name changed over the years, and his father's name on Krypton was Jor-El, and he came to this planet. Jor-El was a brilliant scientist on Krypton who understood that the planet was about to explode. And instead of rescuing everybody from the planet, all the elders thought that this guy was a nut, and they just didn't believe him. So right before the planet explodes, he has a small spacecraft that can basically fit his baby son, and he sends the infant son off towards planet Earth, which he thinks has an environment similar enough to Krypton that the baby will survive. No idea what's going to happen. He sends the baby off in a rocket ship. The planet explodes, and Jor-El and his wife go with him. And suddenly, a year or two later, this baby is now an infant who has come to Earth and shows up in the heartland, not far from where you are there in Detroit, and is discovered by a couple, a passing motorist named Kent. And they take the baby, they adopt him as their own, and thus begins the life of Clark Kent and Superman.
Huh. And he was created by a couple of urbanites, but yet set in the Midwest. Tell us a little about the creators.
The creators were intriguing to me because they're the story of Superman as he's played out repeatedly over the last 75 years. They were two Jewish teenagers in Cleveland, Ohio, in the middle of the Great Depression. One of them, a guy named Jerry Siegel, had just lost his dad during a robbery at his dad's haberdashery store. Jerry is the sixth of six kids of this Lithuanian immigrant, and he's lost not just his dad, but his mentor and his hero. So this is a young man looking for a hero at a time when America is in a crisis and it needs a hero. And I don't think in the history of American publishing there's been better timing with the launch of a new book than the idea of Superman in the middle of the Depression, on the eve of World War II, when America needed not just a hero, but a strong man who would give them a sense of their own strength.
Do you think the two creators were aware, since they were teenagers, oftentimes teenagers aren't too aware of world events, some are, that what they were immersed in, I mean, the fact that the Superman character was strong and could had superpowers in an era when everything was so unsure?
I think it was partly a question of their personal circumstances. As I said, Jerry had lost his dad. His artist buddy, Joe Shuster, had a family that was down and out, and they wanted to live in a world that was better than their world, and creating their own fantasy world is what kids do generally. So it was partly a matter of these kids having been creative and come up with a fantasy that worked for them. And the idea that it worked at that moment in history so well for America, I think was largely a matter of luck. They did have a sense that the country was a bit down and out, but giving them sort of a global feeling of what was going on in the outside world is much more than I think they would have even claimed credit for. They just knew that they needed a hero, and the fact that their hero played so well for the country and eventually the world was just, as I say, a matter of serendipity and of their being creative.
It's interesting, the name Superman. We, of course, have when anyone says Superman, one either imagines a cartoon figure or, in popular culture, it's someone who has great powers or, you know, that's a Superman of football, or even you hear it used in any number of different ways. Yet in Nietzsche's, the German philosopher, his Übermensch translates pretty loosely into Superman. Could those Jewish kids have been aware that that of this connection and the fact that the Nazis were actually mistakenly attaching themselves to Nietzsche's philosophy?
I think that they probably wouldn't have been aware of it generally anyway, but the fact is that they invented their character, and it took them a couple years to sell it. And my sense is that the chance of their having been aware at an even earlier era than when Superman was published, that their character had any connection to what Nietzsche was doing and to what the Germans were doing in either adopting or perverting, as some people say, the Nietzschean vision of this Übermensch, I think is a stretch. Their Superman also started out initially as S-U-P-E-R hyphen, capital M-A-N, and it started out as a bad guy, not as a heroic figure, and over time, they dropped the hyphen, and they added this sense of nobility, and I think that they understood, they were smart enough to know that a good guy was an easier sell to a country that they wanted to sell comic books or comic strips to than an evil hero. We had plenty of evil heroes in the world then, evil figures, and they wanted somebody that people could see as a source of light and of righteousness.
Yet, Larry Tye, you think Superman was Jewish?
I do think he was Jewish.
We're talking Krypton, the planet Krypton, to Kansas. There is the number of Jews in Kansas in the 1930s you could probably count on one hand. What? How could he be Jewish?
I think that's a great point, and the reason I think he's Jewish, the evidence for it is partly the name that he came from Krypton with. It was Kal-El, which in Hebrew means a vessel of God. And it was, I think, the story of Exodus. The parents send off their son, who they're afraid will be killed, and sort of float him out. Instead of on the Nile River, they're floating him out in the air. He's adopted by a Gentile couple in the middle of Kansas, which is precisely what happened to Moses when he was found by the Pharaoh's daughter in Egypt. And the destruction of the planet is straight out of Genesis. The saving of the little baby is straight out of Exodus, and there are sort of five or six other little hints that I think that were not accidental that these two Jewish kids threw in there. To me, the most fun of those is the fact that any name that ends in man, whether it's Silberman or any name that ends in man, is either a superhero or Jewish. But the fact that I think he was Jewish hasn't stopped Christians from adopting him as the perfect Christ story. God sends his, you know, son to earth to save mankind. Buddhists see it as a perfect Zen story. And atheists see Superman as the ultimate secular hero. So I think we love this hero enough that we each call him our own.
The book is Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Larry Tye, T-Y-E, is my guest. And you can go to LarryTye.com, and it'll be there. Plus all of his other wonderful books that we've interviewed him about in the past. Now, let's get a little back to the origins of the introduction of Superman to the American public. How did these two young kids sell this comic strip, this comic book to, I'm forgetting, was it Marvel or it was DC, right? Yeah, DC.
It was DC.
Yeah.
They did it with great patience and great anxiety. They would send it off. They initially envisioned it not as a comic book, but as a comic strip, and that was the big deal in those days. Newspapers were running comic strips. Comic books were a whole new enterprise. They sent it off to every publisher they could, and they'd sometimes get nice responses saying no. Sometimes they'd get no response at all, and it took them a couple years of fine-tuning the character and persisting with this, and finally they found these people who were about to start DC Comics and were looking for a bunch of stories. The people who published the first Superman had no idea it was going to be a success. The kids had no idea, Jerry and Joe, that it was going to work. And what happened was that it was on the cover on some issues, and some issues it went inside. And they started noticing that every time Superman was on the cover, that the comic book would sell off the stands immediately, and they'd have to order tens of thousands of new copies. And it was as instantaneous a success as you ever find in a field of sort of pop culture like that. He just took off in a way that tapped a nerve that nobody, not the publisher, and not the writers or the artist had ever envisioned.
Now, there was a Superman number one comic, right?
There was indeed, and that was with him on the cover.
And how much did that sell for? Was it 10 cents?
That was under 10 cents in those days. I think the first one was about 8 cents, and it was an experiment. I mean, it cost them almost nothing to produce it, and it was an outgrowth of what they used to call the pulp fiction, these sort of romantic or even pornographic stories that would sell. They called it penny pulp fiction because they would actually sometimes sell for just a penny. And those took off in a way that was such that they decided that a more explicit kids audience with more heroic stories might work, And Superman, it was on Superman's muscle-bound back that not just the idea of these superheroes took off, but the idea of the comic book itself.
Now, so under 10 cents, if I wanted to go buy that number one now, how much would it cost me?
Well, right now, if you had a mint condition Superman Action Comics number one, you could get easily $1 million for it.
That's all. Pardon me. That always strikes me as so absolutely incredible. Larry Tye is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. It's published by Random House, and I think this is, like so many of Larry's other books, is going to be flying off the shelves, speaking about flying. Were there superheroes before Superman that flew and had incredible powers and all that? I mean, I know there were heroes, but were they like Superman, or was this the first?
There were heroes like Superman, and ones that he actually borrowed from. There was a character named Doc Savage. There was a character named Hugo Danner, who was written up in a great book called The Gladiator. There were a number of heroes that he borrowed from. He also explicitly borrowed from Samson and from the Greek heroes like Hercules, but there was none that quite combined the powers that Superman did and quite tapped into this idea of the alter ego of Clark Kent.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, as we see in the heroes that came before and that came after, if a hero had a disguise, the disguise was generally who the real character was, and the hero was what they dressed up as to sort of disguise who they were. In the case of Superman, what was unique, and I think what made it special, was that the real character was the hero, was Superman, who disguised himself as Clark Kent rather than the other way around. And what it really was Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster and every kid in America in that era. Now, the schlubbier you looked, and the more likely that you were wearing spectacles and that you were a little bit short and a little bit round, the more you were convinced that if people could only see inside you, they'd see there was a superhero buried in there. And that's what I think Jerry Siegel was doing in creating Superman and Clark Kent.
You know, when we talk about his disguise, you think, well, let me see, he had glasses and a suit on, and then he changes into this bodysuit. And in your book, Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, there's great, cartoons and photographs. And at one point, and this is interesting, this has, I think, a lot to do with the way things have changed. In a comic from 1966, Superman is burst into this door, and he says, "I'll tell you why I'll never marry you, Lana, or you, Lois. Who wants a wife so stupid she doesn't realize I'm Superman when I take off my Clark Kent glasses?" That's absolutely incredible.
That is incredible, and that's a wonderful sort of part of the game of the whole Superman Clark Kent thing was that on TV, in the movies, and even in the comic books, they look so alike that just everybody was saying, you know, how could you be that stupid? And that part of what went on, whatever medium he was in, Superman was essentially winking at the readers and saying, you know who I am, and these people, everybody wanted to play along, that they so bought into the whole idea. If you're buying into the fact that Superman can fly and that he has these incredible powers of X-ray vision and super hearing, why not buy into the fact that people were dumb enough to sort of accept his disguise? And at various times over the years, the writers tried to offer explanations that the public was hypnotized by his glasses or that there was something strange going on. But they realized these explanations were unnecessary, that we were all willing to buy into this whole story because we loved the whole righteous character that we were creating, and we wanted to have those kinds of powers ourselves. And it was our fantasy being played out as well as a morality tale.
Well, you know, Larry Tye, it occurred to me when I saw this that how sort of postmodern that was, that you've kind of are looking, or you're being told the magician's trick or something like that. It was pure innocence. I mean, he saved the world, and Superman did, and caught malefactors and criminals and what have you. But suddenly, you know, people kind of got wise to what was behind the scenes and had to, and the comics kind of reflected that as well. They increasingly, these comic book characters and superheroes had more and more human flaws. They weren't perfect anymore.
That's very true. And essentially the comic books and their superheroes were changing at the same time America was changing. The reason Superman has lasted for 74 years and counting is that he evolved more than the fruit fly, that essentially every era got a Superman that they could relate to. And in the first days, he was the great crusading New Deal liberal when we were in the middle of the New Deal. By the time of the Reagan Revolution, he had moved rightward, and his politics were more conservative, and his defense of the status quo as opposed to the underdog was more transparent. And every era, the change was the subtlety, the sense of them being more nuanced characters and not perfect. All of that was part of who we were. And that's the brilliant thing about Superman. Today, to kids, they see him as his hero the same way I did in the 1960s and Jerry Siegel did in the 1930s.
Well, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the original creators, so they must be, and their heirs must be multimillionaires, right?
Well, they could become multi-millionaires. The sad news is that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster died. Jerry Siegel's wife recently died, and the heirs are getting more and more removed from them. But they're also, they're in the middle of a major lawsuit. They were trying to reclaim the rights that Jerry and Joe sold in the 1930s for $130 between the two of them.
Oh.
And these rights today will easily be worth tens of millions and could be in the hundreds of millions. And it looks like they're going to get a major award if they don't reach a settlement. And we're talking huge amounts of money here.
Now, did they continue to create Superman? And were they paid well during the 30s and 40s and 50s, all that?
They did. Through the 1940s, they were paid very well. They were paid a salary. They never had ownership of the character because they had given that away at the beginning, but they earned salaries that today would be hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and they did quite well. But then they filed the lawsuit. They decided they were entitled to actually own the character. To make a long story short, the lawsuit alienated them from DC Comics, and they ended up parting ways. And through a lot of their adult life, Jerry and Joe lived pretty close to a pauper-like existence.
Hmm.
Then in the 1970s, when the big Superman movies happened, DC Comics gave them substantial annual annuities, and that worked well until they decided in the 1990s to file more lawsuits, and the And today, it looks like they might be close to winning that lawsuit.
Now, compare, if you would, the comics and the creativity there and the nature of the stories with these movies. I remember I saw only one with Superman and Richard Pryor. Oh, they were awful. What do you think of those?
I think that most of the movies were pretty bad. The first one in 1978, which is called just Superman the Movie, it was the first Christopher Reeve movie, and the marketing slogan for the movie was, "You will believe a man can fly." And for the first time ever, Superman, on either a small screen or a big screen, really looked like he belonged up there flying. And that was a really terrific movie. And from there, they started going downhill. And some of them have been really horrible. This summer, actually, they're going to release a Superman animated movie, and next summer there's going to be another blockbuster live-action Superman, and I hope it's more on the idea of the original Christopher Reeve than on lots of the movies like the Richard Pryor one, which was miserable.
Well, speaking of miserable, when you see all these superhero movies today with the modern superheroes, they're always filled with angst, or they have emotional problems, or what have you. Is Superman ever going to be portrayed as having those human characteristics to the extent that the ones that we see in recent movies, you think?
I hope not.
And yeah,
I agree. One of the things that distinguishes Superman from Spider-Man, who's really fraught with anxiety, and from Batman, who's a pretty dark character, what distinguishes Superman is this sense of light. And I think that we have enough darkness and enough dark heroes in our world, and I hope Superman stays the way he was.
And Superman, though, has died a couple of times, right?
He's died repeatedly in the comic books. He died in a record-selling issue that actually sold 6 million copies in the 1990s. But what anybody who's familiar with the comics knows, you kill him off today, and you figure out a storyline to bring him back tomorrow. So he died, and he was resurrected, and It partly resurrected the whole comic book sales of Superman.
And comic books like that are no longer for kids. In fact, would you say that adults are the biggest audience these days?
They are. I would say that adults who have never quite grown up are the biggest audience, and they're, I think, the only people who can afford comic books today, which are several dollars, you know, as opposed to the 10 cents that we were starting out with. And it's partly that they've gotten more expensive, and it's partly that the storylines have gotten more adult-oriented. But it's a much smaller audience of comic books than it ever was, and a more adult-oriented one. But what gives me faith that Superman will go on forever is that every time I think that it's a little niche audience, something will happen like this TV show Smallville, and an entire generation of American kids will get re-addicted to the character and will want to see him in a movie, in an animated film. And I think his storyline is such that DC Comics and Time Warner, which own him, recognize that they'd be pretty dumb to give up on their number one franchise of a hero.
And Larry Tye, you're off to Metropolis, Superman's home, am I correct?
I am off to Metropolis. What better place to launch the book than in a town in the middle of Illinois called Metropolis, where they have an annual Superman festival that draws 30,000 people.
Wow. So this, I assume they changed the name, right, to take advantage of this, right? I mean,
actually, Metropolis was always called Metropolis, but they changed the focus. They realized, I don't know if it was 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that with a name like that, they had to link themselves to Superman. So the biggest tourist attractions in town are the Superman Museum and all the statues. And I'm going to be in Metropolis with the woman who played in the original TV Superman series, Lois Lane, and lots of other people who played him in Smallville and other settings.
That's absolutely incredible. Well, it's up and away with Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. My guest has been Larry Tye. That's T-Y-E, and you can go to LarryTye.com. There'll also be a link to the book on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Thanks for being part of Truth, Justice, and the American Way, Larry Tye.
Peter, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Yeah. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you, and it's a pleasure to welcome a Detroiter back home, someone who has made a mark in the rock and roll world for several decades now. It's Wayne Kramer, and I'm sure most of you know he began his career with as the lead guitar of the MC5. In fact, Rolling Stone said he's one of the top 100 guitarists of all times in rock and roll, and his career since then has been absolutely amazing. We'll get to a lot of that, but right now, as they used to say, Brother Wayne Kramer, welcome home.
Thanks, Peter. Happy to be here.
Well, you've been a busy lad since those grandy days of the 1960s. In fact, the MC5 was the first played at the opening of the Grandy Ballroom and the closing night as well.
We bookended it.
we saw that in the film. Have you seen the Grandy Ballroom film?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
No.
Well, it was absolutely great, and talk about bringing back memories. But you know, I think I'd actually begin with a question: is when you've had a career that spans the 1960s through the new millennium, and people are still saying, "Yeah, kick out the jams." Do you want to say, "Look, that was a long time ago. I'm doing all of this right now. I've done all this. I've done this HBO music, score writing and all that." Or are they equally important?
Well, I mean, kick out the jams is an eternal expression. I mean, it's fresh every time you use it, and it's always in right now. Right now is the only time you can kick out the jams. You can't kick out the jams yesterday or tomorrow. You can only kick out the jams right now. So it all, you know, it's always good. And, you know, it's a song that I wrote, and me and Rob Tyner sat at the kitchen table and wrote that song. And, it's a ball to play it. I still play it almost every time I play out. I do the tune, and it always works. The crowd always goes crazy when we play it. And I think it's just one of those, I guess we call it an evergreen.
Sure. Well, we play it on our HD station here. And, of course, we do not play those famous, it's, you know, Kick Out the Jams, MF. And that got you guys in a lot of trouble when you would play it at clubs all around town. There, they would just wait for Rob Tyner, the lead singer of the MC5, to say, all right, time two. And there'd be this big pause and then Kick Out the Jams, MF. And then boom, bam, boom, you guys would all wind up in police cars.
Yeah, it's imagine it's impossible for anyone that isn't our age to remember or to know what that was like, you know, that you could actually be arrested for using words that everybody uses every day, you know, and effectively got the MC5 kicked out of the record business, you know. Let me tell you that. But since we're on the subject of Kick Out the Jams, you know, there's been a number of bands that have covered the song over the years. Henry Rollins and the Bad Brains did a terrific version of it. I love Rage Against the Machine's version of it. But my favorite version of Kick Out the Jams is by an Australian band called Deep Street Soul.
Wow.
If you hear it, you'll find out the truth of the MC5.
Wayne Kramer, former lead guitar of the MC5, and now with 10 solo albums under his belt, and a lot of work about social justice and prison reform, which we'll get to in just a little while. But we were talking before this how the system previously was so rigid, but now is able to accommodate any hairstyle, any music, any rude language, and so... But now you when you say Kick Out the Jams, MF, it's almost just like a nostalgia point.
Takes us back to the thrilling days of yesteryear. Yeah, I think that in some ways America has grown up. You know, in many other ways, maybe more important ways, it hasn't. But in some ways, the idea of language on the airways, you know, with satellite radio and cable television. That you can portray things in a more realistic manner. We don't have to have the Victorian, you know, 50s censorship hanging over our heads all the time. And believe me, it makes for better art.
You know, I was just thinking about how many times when you're reading the music press that the MC5 is referred to. And, you know, a seminal rock band, a seminal punk band, stage theatrics that set the style and the pace. When you guys were doing that, you couldn't have possibly had any thought that you were actually making history. Did you realize that you were a cut above everything else that was going on?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. In fact, we used to discuss was something that we're doing historically valid.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Rob, it was big concern of Rob Tyner's. You know, he was just a genius.
Sure.
Artist. And a lot of times, you know, we would be talking about doing, you know, a song and a musical arrangement or maybe some performance concept that we were trying to work on. And the subject would come up when we'd have to kick that back and forth. Is this going to hold up? You know, what's this going to be like in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? Or, you know, is this, so timely that it won't be meaningful 10 years from now or 20 years from now? It was actually something we talked about.
Now, your bandmates, Rob Tyner and Fred Sonic Smith and Michael Davis, have all passed away, all at very young ages. So that must have a hole in your heart, certainly a hole in our musical heritage, to be sure, because those guys would still be playing. Michael playing right up to his death.
We played a concert together last summer in France in DKT MC5, and... I knew then that Michael was very, very ill. He couldn't stand to play. He had to play the gig sitting down. And it wasn't as though his death was unexpected. You know, we knew he was very ill. You know, Rob and Fred's deaths were very hard to, you know, to describe, really, because, you know, we grew up together. We were schoolboys.
Lincoln Park.
Yeah, and downriver there. And, and we went through so much together, and then one day they're not here anymore. They're not in the world anymore. And recently with Michael leaving too, it just reminds me that time is finite, you know, and life is finite. And if you're going to do anything, if you're going to, you know, accomplish anything, you only get so much time. You know, time is the most valuable thing I have.
Sure. Wayne Kramer, formerly the MC5, solo artist in his own right, and we're going to talk in a little while about all the music he's done for HBO and PBS and what have you. Also, his project called Jail Guitar Doors USA that he's done with British singer-songwriter Billy Bragg, who's been on this show any number of times. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. Well, I've often, in fact, as you may have heard, Farouk Z. Bey, a staple of Detroit jazz, passed away recently. And it occurred to me that many ways you often, as a, you can have your choice of being a musician or live to 94. Yet you look just healthy as all get out, and you know, it's. But it's not a ticket for being a musician. Is not a ticket for a long life, is it?
High attrition rate in this game.
Yeah.
Because you know, it's an unorthodox life. It has a great benefits, great fringe benefits, and you get to do things that you wouldn't normally think are possible. But, you know, having come up, you know, through the 60s, we all experimented with drugs. Everybody, I didn't know anyone that didn't take
experiment.
Some kind of drug.
I always say, and it was successful.
Yeah.
A successful experiment.
It was. But some of us, a small percentage of us, cross over into active addiction and alcoholism. And these are fatal. These are fatal disorders if left untreated.
But that happened to you in a very, very serious way.
I am a sober alcoholic. I'm a clean drug addict, and and I was out there for a long time. You know, it was a way, a coping mechanism for me.
Self-medicating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I fell into recovery. I stumbled and tripped and fell into recovery, and I found a way to live where drinking and drugs aren't necessary. And I end up, you know, kind of figuring out what's important and what isn't important. So, you know, I'm very fortunate.
Well, and this kind of leads us into Jail Guitar Doors USA, one of your projects, besides all the great music that you do. You wound up on the wrong side of bars, right?
Well, I did. After the band broke up, I really lost my way. You know, I had my whole life was invested in the MC5. I was the band leader. I got the guys together. And I'd really achieved all my ambitions and goals by the time I was 19 years old. You know, here I was in a hugely popular band here in Detroit.
The MC5,
we could draw 2,000 or 3,000 kids to a performance at the Grandy. I could make a living as a professional musician. I was getting all the sex I could handle. And that was considerable in those days.
Including under the stage. I'm not giving anything away. Never mind. But that's in the movie. That's in the Grandy Ballroom movie. I'm not talking out of school.
And I was part of a community. You know, I had great friends and comrades, and we were living through exciting and dangerous times. And then one day it all went away. You know, the truth is that at least what I know now, looking back on, is the center never holds. And the way things are today, they won't be like this 5 years from now. And one day I didn't have the band anymore, and didn't have my way to make money, and didn't have my friends, and didn't have my community and my support system. And I really lost it. Talent isn't enough. Talent, knowing how to play the guitar or write a song or dance on stage, isn't enough. And when times got tough, I started slipping down, and my drug use and my alcoholism really took over. And I fell into a way of life that was kind of a backwards, you know, a bizarro way of life, where what used to be good was considered bad, and what used to be considered bad was now good. Hmm. You know, like if you did wrong, you were admired for that, you know.
You're a rebel.
Yeah, and I went all the way with it, and I ended up with a four-year federal prison term, thanks to the Honorable Judge Robert J. DiMasio in federal court in downtown Detroit.
And you served, what, just a little over 2 years?
I did 2.5 on it.
Yeah, that must have been literally a sobering experience.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, they give you time to think.
Yeah.
And had a long time to contemplate how I got there and what I could do to not come back. And fortunately, I never did go back, unlike most people that go to prison. But I, you know, and I learned some things about myself and about addiction and recovery, but the state of the art wasn't as finely tuned as it is today. And I still came out and continued to drink and drug for many years afterwards. It took me a long time to finally hit that bottom.
Wayne Kramer is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Wayne Kramer, singer-songwriter. He's got 10 solo albums, and I don't want to let him leave without talking about all the film and documentary and work he's done scoring these great television shows as well, and also his project, Jail Guitar Doors USA. When you came out of prison, I know you, for a while, hooked up with Johnny Thunder. And I remember I saw you guys at the old Miami bar on Cass, and the sound that was coming out of your amplifiers, I had myself pinned behind this little alcove, or I thought I would have started bleeding from the ears.
Good. That was our intention.
All right. So, but let's jump, because this is part of what this is all about is why you had just come from Washington, D.C. and talking to some United States senators, which is a long way from some of the other stuff we were talking about.
It's a long way from the Grandy Ballroom.
Yes. Yeah. Tell us about Jail Guitar Doors USA and what that's all about.
Well, while I was in prison, this new music movement emerged called punk rock, and there was a band in England called The Clash,
Sure. Great.
who were great admirers of the MC5. And when they heard I went to prison, they wrote a song about me and a couple other guys having trouble with the authorities, and the song was called Jail Guitar Doors.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and so when I got out, I went down. They came to Detroit to play, and I went over to see them and thank them And I thought it was like, a show of solidarity. My British brothers, musicians, reaching out to another musician. And I didn't think much of it until about 3 years ago. I had put together a group of musicians, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, Perry Farrell and his wife Etty, Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains, Gilby Clark from Guns N' Roses, Handsome Dick Manitoba, Don Was.
Yeah.
And one of the guys I asked to come with me was Billy Bragg. I'd known Billy. You see him around. We all run into each other in our working life. And Billy had Jail Guitar Doors written on his guitar. And I said, "That's interesting, Bill." And he said, "Oh, yeah, it's an old Clash B-side. Have you ever heard it?"
Yeah,
and I said, "Hey, Bill, the song is about me." And he said, "Right. Oh, blimey, I forgot. It is about you, isn't it?" And he tells me the story that he started an independent initiative in England because a man had called him who worked in a prison who was trying to use music as rehabilitation with addicts, but they didn't have any guitars. And could Billy find him some guitars? And he saw it as a way to honor the life of Joe Strummer. And he called it Jail Guitar Doors, named after the Clash song. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just started the wheels turning in my little damaged brain that okay, Bill, you're in England, and this is a good thing you're doing, but I'm an American, and, you know, I am an ex-prisoner, and I'm in music here, and maybe I should take this on for myself. Because really, It's the antidote for my alcoholism and my drug addiction. You know, one thing we learn when we start to go inward to find out what the hell's wrong with us as alcoholics and addicts is we're incredibly selfish. I am selfish and self-centered and self-seeking to my core. It's the source of my problem. Is, you know, you can come first right after me.
But it also is, and this is not unusual for creative people, it also is what drives creativity frequently, always.
Absolutely, yeah. But, of course, like most things, I go too far with it because I'm an extremist.
Yeah, okay.
And so the antidote for that is to be of service to my fellows, you know, to be a worker amongst workers, to be a fellow amongst fellows, no better, no worse. And to do something for somebody else, to go out of my way to do something for somebody else. And so it all fit together for me that, you know, Jail Guitar Doors, you know, I have one foot in prison. I have one foot in music. I could be a bridge. I have a great community around me of other musicians. JGD is a musician-founded, musician-operated nonprofit charity. And so we took it on. Me and Billy and my wife Margaret formed JGD USA. And so we're going into our third year now. And what we do is simple. We find people that work in corrections that are willing to use music as rehabilitation, and we provide them with guitars. So far, we've been in over a dozen prisons, California, Arizona, Nevada, Texas, New York.
And you're welcomed by the prison authorities. They think this is a good idea?
Most of them.
Most of
them. We're having some trouble getting into the federal prisons.
Oh.
The federals seem to have a little harsher line that they draw, but the states are so broke and so overcrowded with prisoners. There's no money for programs anymore. There is no rehabilitation in prison in America today. And so when they hear that we can help them, that we can provide them with musical instruments, they're thrilled to see us coming. And sometimes we produce live concert events in prison. We have one we're scheduled to do next month at Lancaster in the California Department of Corrections, which is the largest maximum security facility in the state.
You play the old Johnny Cash song? That would be appropriate.
No.
I killed a man, and they all go, yeah!
Yeah, yeah. No, this is we play everything. You know, we play Jailbreak.
Really?
We play fun. Wish You Were Here. we play. It's amazing the stuff we get away with.
If you'd like to hook on to this and find out more about it, it's jailguitardoors.org. Jailguitardoors.org. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com as well. Wayne Kramer is my guest, songwriter and a guitar player who Rolling Stone designated as one of the top 100 guitarists of all times. And I want to get back to that, but real quickly, I promised I would tell people also about all the scoring you had done for film and television. I didn't, you know, I got to tell you, I didn't even know you were doing all that. And you got a host of credits to, you know, you have a host of credits, yeah.
Well, I've been very fortunate. You know, I moved to Los Angeles in 94 with an eye towards film and TV work. You know, I'd been getting in the van for a long time, and, I really enjoyed it in my 30s and in my 40s and even into my 50s. I'm 64 now, and I still love to play live. I play live often. I play live a lot. I still go on tour in the summer. In fact, last summer I was on tour all year with all summer with Marianne Faithfull.
Oh. Great,
the wonderful Marianne Faithfull.
Oh, wow.
As her.
And you did duets?
No, I just was a member of the band.
Okay, all right.
But, you know, scoring is, it was a chance for me to get into something new that I always felt, you know, I could plug into that. I thought I could do that. And, I get a chance to be the new guy again, you know, and there's a whole learning curve to scoring to picture. And it's not for most musicians. Most musicians are not cut out for it because it's not your music anymore. It's the director's music, and you're not the deal. You're not the focus of attention anymore. The story is the focus. So I've been fortunate. I scored three seasons of Eastbound and Down for HBO. I've done a half dozen or so feature films. I've got a couple more that I'm looking at now, and I've been able to keep working and learning, really. I've gone back to school, you know.
Sure.
My history in rock and roll didn't actually prepare me for where do you put the French horns and the violins, you know.
You know, oftentimes, Wayne Kramer, when I am interviewing people and I see, like we have now, about 3.5 minutes, I'm usually interviewing authors, and I'm saying, you know, well, there's so much more to talk about, but that's why this man has written a book. Wayne Kramer, MC5, your prisons, film, everything. You got to crank out a memoir, my friend.
Actually, yeah. I have been. I've got probably 80 or 90,000 words written, and I'm trying to get it down because I just feel like I got to set the record straight, you know, at least tell the story from my perspective. You know, I talk to so many writers and journalists, and you know, they get paid for telling my story. And I said, well, hell, why shouldn't I get paid for telling my story?
real quickly, because Wayne Kramer, you were invited to, and you're going to speak today, to the Association of Alternative Newspapers, which includes Detroit's Metro Times. Is this, are you going to be talking about prison reform? Is that what, or?
Well, arts and activism. Oh, okay. You know, how is it that some artists connect with efforts out bigger than their career, you know, and try to use the platform that we have. Guys like Peter Werby invite you over to their radio show, and you get a chance to talk on the air, to talk about something that might actually make a difference, you know. And I think what I'm trying to do is get this conversation started out in the world about mass incarceration in America. You know, we are in the middle of the greatest failure of social policy in America's domestic history. We have over 2.5 million of our neighbors locked up in prison. We lock up people in America at 5 times the rate of the rest of the world. Either we're the most evil people in the history of the world, or we're doing something terribly wrong about locking people up.
As you know, it's called the prison industrial complex, and we need to produce clients for that huge economic apparatus.
Yeah, and it was a surefire vote getter. There was great political expediency. You know, nobody ever lost an election being tough on crime. And even as crime has been going down over the last 2 decades, they've been building more and more prisons and sentencing people to more and more severe sentences, longer and longer periods of time. And what's happened is it's reached a tipping point where it's now unsustainable. That in California, for example, we spend more on prisoners than we do on higher education.
Wow.
The states are broke. They can't afford to lock this many people up. And the end result is, you know, 90% of the people that go to prison are coming out one day, and they're going to live next door to you and me. And if you've been locked up for decades and inculcated in a world of violence, racism, bitterness, and defeat, and they plop you back out on the street, you're not only not better, you're worse.
Well, wait,
so we're less safe.
Yeah. I want to thank you, Wayne Kramer, and I can see this, what has been called this arc of justice, beginning with the beginning of the MC5 in the 1960s and right up to your art and activism today. You can go to jailguitardoors.org. Also, waynekramer.com is a good place to check out as well. And you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. Brother Wayne Kramer, welcome home.
Thank you, Brother Peter Werby. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be with you. Happy to be within earshot of all my mainline mellows out there.